I'll call the meeting to order, and we have a very tight schedule. Obviously, you're 35 minutes late already. What I intend to do is let people testify on each of the bills first, and then we'll come back take amendments and vote, because we have a lot of people that have come quite a distance, and some of them can't be back here tonight, so I'd like to let them testify, and then we'll go back through all the bills, and we'll probably have to come back tonight to finish up. So we're going to start with House File 485. If I can find
what's the what?
She was here a second ago. There
well,
she is.
Let's see here. That's this one. Alan.
The mics are strong.
You want to hear what?
So, Representative Allen, would you move your bill for? Is this going to be laid over?
Yeah.
Where's this going?
Go.
Yeah.
Doug, does this have a fiscal note?
No.
Okay, so it's just there's the appropriation.
There is. Okay. So, if you would move your bill, and then it'll be laid over for possible inclusion.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I move that House File 485 be laid over and can be considered for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Okay. Present your bill then, or at least briefly present your bill, and then we'll go to the testifiers, and then we'll move on to the next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've done this a few times, so I think we're pretty brief. House File 485 and the No Wrong Door Report, which is included in your materials, are the product of 18 months of hard work on the part of service providers, law enforcement professionals, philanthropy, advocates, and survivors of sex trafficking from around the state, with coordination input from the Departments of Public Safety, Health and Human Services, and the generous financial support of the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. It represents the best ideas and best practices from around our state and around the country. The bill will put in place a statewide system of safe and secure shelter, trauma-informed care and services, and comprehensive training for law enforcement and others to effectively identify victims and to aggressively investigate and prosecute cases of child sex trafficking. It is an evidence-based, trauma-informed model. Stopping the trafficking of our children is not only a moral imperative, but also a sound investment for the state of Minnesota. A 2012 cost-benefit study conducted by the University of Minnesota and Indiana State University showed a savings of 34 state tax dollars for every dollar invested in a model like the Safe Harbor No Wrong Door model. And Mr. Chair introduced Jeff Bauer, Director of Public Policy of the Family Partnership, to walk through the bill.
Welcome to the committee, and would you state your name for the tape?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jeff Bauer. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Family Partnership. And I first just want to give a big thank you to Representative Allen for being our champion on this bill. As some of you know, we've been through kind of an epic journey through all the policy committees over the last few weeks. She's just done a tremendous job throughout all of those committees. I also want to thank many of you on this committee. When I look around the table, I think over half of you are bill authors on this bill. And so I want to give you a big thank you for making that commitment. And then I also want to give a quick thank you to some folks in the room. We have a group from Duluth, a group from St. Cloud, a group from Rochester, and others who came here just to be here today. So thank you all for traveling so far to come in support of this bill. So as most of you will remember, on July 20th, 2011, Minnesota became the fifth state in the nation to pass the Safe Harbor Bill. And what that Safe Harbor Bill did was it said that children who have been trafficked for sex in our state would no longer be treated as criminals and put in the juvenile justice system, but they'd be treated instead as the victims of crime. And so we celebrated very briefly because we knew we had a lot of work ahead of us when that bill passed. What some of you might not know is that Minnesota's Safe Harbor Bill actually isn't in effect yet, and it doesn't go into effect until August 2014. And the reason that was, and you'll hear a little bit more about this from our friends in law enforcement, was that at that time what we were hearing from law enforcement was, you know, we don't think that these children are criminals any more than you do, and we don't want to bring them to juvenile detention any more than you want us to. So if you can tell us where else we should bring them, we're happy to do it. And the problem all around the state was that place did not exist. And I'll tell you today, that place still does not exist for these children. And so from the time that we passed this law, we have spent a lot of time developing a model, and what I really feel is a nation-leading model in Minnesota. And so where we sit today is we have the model, the work has been done, and we have to implement it. So 16 months from today, our safe harbor law goes into effect, and we need to have a place for these kids to go. I think the model we've presented is conservative in its financing, and it's realistic. Believe me, we considered adding some padding to this bill, and we didn't. We came in with what we really believe is the minimum amount needed to take care of this problem. So for the purposes of this committee, if we can just go straight to Article 3, because I know you're short on time, and go to the appropriations in this bill. There are a number of items that you'll see. The first is $762,000 to fund six regional navigator positions around the state. Now, what these positions would be is grant-funded. They would be housed within existing organizations in regionally, so roughly northeast, northwest, southeast, southwest, and two in the metro area. And we wanted to leave that flexible so that, you know, what works in Bemidji might not work in Duluth or might not work in Rochester. So they might be housed in a youth-serving organization in one place. They might be housed in a county in another place. We wanted to leave that flexibility. So that's what that funding is for. The second item in the Department of Health is a training fund. This is one thing about child sex trafficking cases, or two things, I should say. Victims are notoriously hard to identify without the proper training and knowing the right questions to ask. And the second thing is that these cases are very, very hard to investigate, especially if you see police departments in greater Minnesota where they might have one investigator for every possible case. They need the training to get at the trafficker. So that's what that fund is for. The third line item is program evaluation. Basically, this is a brand new model. This is making sectors and jurisdictions work together in ways that they've never worked together in the state. And so we want to make sure that this is money well spent. We want to make sure we're getting the outcomes that we say we're getting. And so we put some money into evaluation. Next line item are grants for outreach workers, also around the state, 14 of them, also housed in existing organizations, because we know that we're not getting to these kids right now. They're falling through the cracks. They're not being identified. We need to go out and find them. So we wanted to fund more outreach workers. Moving on, we also asked for $1 million in each of the next 2 years for what we're calling the Safe Harbor Services Fund. This is really a comprehensive services fund. You know, these children come in needing everything that you can imagine because of what they've been through. And so this would be a fund that could go for things like healthcare service, mental health service, family reunification, employment training, all kinds of different things, and we'd imagine that would be, those categories would be developed in an RFP process and granted out. And then last but not least, in the Department of Health, we have $82,550 for each of the years to fund a statewide director of child sex trafficking prevention position. That's a fully loaded salary with benefits and all that. We got it right out of the state of Minnesota salary handbook, so that's where that number comes from. But again, because this is such a new model, it's so comprehensive, we really need someone who's looking out, holding the pieces together, administering grant funds, collecting data, all of those things. So moving on to the Department of Human Services, everything that is in this category has to do with safe shelter and housing for child sex trafficking victims. And I want to just be really clear about the type of shelter and housing we're talking about. This housing is not the same as shelter for homeless youth. We know you're also considering an $8 million ask to expand the Homeless Youth Act. We are 1,000,000% in favor of that allocation as well. We know that once a child is on the street, they're at tremendous risk for sexual exploitation, and so we hope that you'll pass that as well. But for children who have been trafficked, there's two specific concerns with their shelter. One is that they're almost always being directly pursued by their trafficker. And so if you put them in a shelter or somewhere else that doesn't take that into account, they're gone the minute they get in there. And so security is a huge concern. The second thing is the level of therapeutic care for these children. They've been through such tremendous trauma. The level of therapy, the level of support they need is much higher. And so that is why there's a separate ask for safe harbor shelter from the homeless youth ask. So if you get into the numbers, roughly half of that ask, $4,472,500, is to operate the shelter beds. There's a variety of different types in this proposal, ranging from the emergency shelter beds, so that first place that a law enforcement officer or someone else can bring a child at 2 in the morning when they find them, all the way through different transitional housing. The other piece that I'm really excited about in this is the last line item, which is foster care. This is a model that they've been using with some success in Portland and Seattle and other places, where they actually have specially trained foster families that take these children in, and in some cases that's really the best situation, so we want to try that out. Final line item is $4 million. This is one-time construction and renovation costs to expand our shelter bed capacity to reach this population. You know, right now, at this very moment, there's 4 shelter beds in the entire state of Minnesota for child sex trafficking victims. 4 beds. And they all exist right here in St. Paul at Breaking Free, who you're going to hear from. We estimate on the low end, on any given night in Minnesota, we're going to need between 35 and 40 once this law goes into effect. So we've got between 4 and 40 to build over the next 16 months. It's no easy lift, but we have to do it. So that's the numbers in a nutshell, and I just want to wrap up by saying, you know, we've been through a lot of policy committees now, we've been through a lot of hearings now, and there's no doubt that morally speaking, the legislature is with us on this. This is a bipartisan bill. I think we've had unanimous votes in every committee except judiciary, which is a story for another time. If you want to hear it, we can meet later. But on the moral ground, we know this has to be done, but now we're talking about the money. And all I want to say about that is in 16 months from now, this law is going to change, and we're going to have trafficked children who need some place to go. And so we're either going to build it or we're not. But in August 2014, there's going to be a whole lot of kids that need somewhere to go. And so I thank you for your consideration. I know you've got some really tough decisions ahead of you with this budget, but I hope you find that this is an investment worth making. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we have Mr. Choi.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Choi, and would you state your name for the table?
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Choi, and I am the Ramsey County Attorney, and I'm honored to be here in support of this very, very important bill, House File 485, and I want to thank Representative Allen for her leadership in bringing this forward. And for you, Mr. Chair, for your public comments about sex trafficking and giving the time that this bill deserves. I really believe that the greatest human rights atrocity that's happening in our community right before our eyes is the buying and selling of children for sex online, and that's happening here in the state of Minnesota. And I want to make sure that this committee understands that the victims of this crime are not children just from St. Paul or Minneapolis, but they're children from all over the state of Minnesota. In fact, if you have runaways in your community, you've got this problem. Because what we know is that runaways, because they're in a vulnerable situation, 30 to 40% of them are going to be sexually exploited. And they're coming from all over the state. In fact, this past year, we prosecuted 12 defendants of trafficking involving children. And those victims, at least almost half of them, come from greater Minnesota. And so I want this committee to understand that this is a statewide problem. And I really believe in order to make a difference around this issue, we need to have a victim-centered approach. And what I mean by that is that we appropriately define who the victims are in these particular situations, and with the safe harbor law and the actions of the 7 county attorneys in the metropolitan area and also in St. Louis and Olmsted counties, we believe that the best approach is to understand that these children who are coming into the system are not criminals, are not delinquents, but they're children in need of protection. and they are victims of crime. And so starting from that premise, what we need to do is to have an approach that makes investment into providing the intervention services, the short-term shelter space, and the long-term housing to really get at that. And the reason why that's so important is because when you start treating these children as victims and you, law enforcement and the people in the system are doing something to help these children, they're more willing in the long run to testify against their trafficker. And that's one of the biggest challenges that we face, is because the victim is going to be so critical in a prosecution. Without that participation, it makes it very difficult to hold the traffickers accountable. But when we have that approach, it works. In fact, just recently in Roseville, there was a 17-year-old girl from outstate Minnesota who was being trafficked at a hotel in Roseville. And because of the victim-centered approach that was used by the Roseville Police Department, by the time that we got to trial, that 17-year-old trusted a police officer named Ben more than she trusted the trafficker who she thought she loved, Samuel Cozart, who was a really bad man. And we were able to get a conviction and a sentence, and it's the longest sentence that I'm aware of in the state of Minnesota for 21 years. But he's in prison for 21 years for his crimes. But that couldn't have been done without the efforts of the law enforcement community and also having some services. And in Ramsey County, we're very lucky because we have developed a runaway intervention program that does offer intensive services for victims. And I think that was a big part of how this case transpired. And I just want to conclude by saying this. When we make this investment, you heard about that if we make a dollar of an investment, we get a return of $34. A lot of that research was done on the runaway intervention program in Ramsey County. But another important part of this is the results. And in order to qualify for the intensive services in the runaway intervention program in Ramsey County, because of the lack of resources, you have to have been sexually exploited two or more times in order to get access to the most intensive services, just quite frankly, because we can't handle more than 75 kids a year. But after a year in that service, it's a public health response, working with a public health nurse. After a year, with respect to three issues, teen pregnancy, suicidal thoughts, and incidences of self-harm, those children who have been sexually exploited two or more times do as well or better than kids in the Minnesota Student Survey, kids who have not been sexually exploited. So when we make these types of investments, they can work, and they can also have a benefit for holding people accountable. So, Mr. Chair and members, this bill provides this really important part of the missing piece that we have right now. We've got it right in terms of defining who the victims are, but we need to have an investment made, and that's the hard part. But I can tell you that if you do make this investment, and we have to make this investment, we will make a difference. We're doing it in Ramsey County, and I know that we can throughout the state of Minnesota to end sex trafficking. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Choi. Is Sergeant Snyder? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sergeant Grant Snyder. I'm a detective with Minneapolis Police Department. I'm the lead investigator on all sex trafficking, human trafficking related crimes for the city of Minneapolis. I appreciate being here today to talk about this legislation, talk about this bill. I appreciate the chance to address you all. I remember the very first juvenile sex trafficking victim that I ever encountered about 13 years ago, and her name was Amanda. And I remember what Amanda looked like in that soiled mattress in the basement on the floor of that crack house when we did that search warrant. I remember her laying there with no pants on, a soiled t-shirt, sores on her legs. She was a runaway, a little girl from northern Minnesota who'd found her way to North Minneapolis. We pulled her out of that crack house. We didn't have the training we needed. We didn't have the right ideology. I didn't see her as a victim at that point. And we sent her to St. Joe's, and she went back home. And home was a hostile place for Amanda. And eventually Amanda would come back to North Minneapolis because she'd been abused sexually by her father and an older brother and had gone on for a long time. So she did what anybody would do. She escaped. She came back to North Minneapolis, and over the next 2 years, I would rescue Amanda six more times. Six times. And every time we pulled Amanda out, we would send her someplace that treated what we believed were to be the most pressing issues at the time. She was a runaway, so we sent her home. She was chemically dependent, so we sent her for chemical dependency treatment. During that process that lasted 2 years until I finally lost touch with her, we never came close to touching the very real issues that affected and caused her to repeatedly be involved in a sex trafficking arrangement. We didn't have the training, we didn't have the resources, and we didn't have the ideology necessary to treat Amanda the way that she needed to be treated and give that little girl what she needed and what so many other little girls out there today need. But we fixed those problems with our ideology. We've started to train police officers around the state. We've started to train people across the country, and we know the right words. We know the correct training. We know the way to approach these victims now. Among the most daunting problems today, though, still remains the resources, and what do we do with these children? Do we send them home? Do we send them to JDC? We know that's not the appropriate place for these kids. We know they're not going to get the treatment that they need there. They're not going to get a staff that understands their trauma. I mean, imagine, we know what it's like to be a sex assault victim. We understand from the very articulate and sometimes tearful words of survivors of sexual assault. And we know how traumatic that experience is. Now, multiply that exponentially by several incidences of sexual assault, of imprisonment, of torture, and all the things that go into being a sex assault, I'm sorry, that go into being a sexual trafficking victim. That's what we're dealing with here, and that's why these resources are so critically important. Last week, we had four new victims. Just yesterday, we found two more little girls, 14 and 16 years old. Next week, there will be more. We're going to have contact with these kids, and we're going to pull them out. But the big challenge for us in law enforcement is, what do we do with them? Where do we put them? Because we can't stop rescuing these kids, but we got to make sure that we're only rescuing them once and not having to rescue them six times.
Thank you for your testimony. And next, we have Sergeant Vandermeer. Thanks. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Vandermeer. I'm a sergeant with the St. Paul Police Department. I'm also the director of the Gerald Vick Human Trafficking Task Force, which is a task force of law enforcement, investigators, and service providers, non-governmental organizations working together to address this issue of human trafficking and what we're here to talk about today, sex trafficking of minors specifically. I can only reiterate what Sergeant Snyder has already told you. The victims, where they come from. County Attorney Choi has explained that this is not just a Twin Cities issue. I have a trial scheduled for next month in Ramsey County, which includes two young girls from the Twin Ports area that were into St. Paul and were sexually trafficked the first day they got here. I was yesterday down in southeastern Minnesota to interview another sexual trafficking victim who was in St. Paul recently. These girls and these kids come from all parts of the state. And we can talk about how, we preach a victim-centered approach to investigating these crimes. And that victim-centered approach means that we have to be able to address the needs of the victims so that we can successfully investigate and prosecute traffickers. But we can't do that if we don't have a place to put them, a safe place to put them, that will address the needs that they have, physical, emotional, mental needs, so that they can be equipped with the tools that they have to have to be able to understand what happened to them and be able to tell us a story. We're law enforcement. We're charged with putting the bad guys in jail. And we need to hear the stories of the victims to do that. And you can't do that in the first interview. You can't do it in the second or third interview oftentimes. This process takes months. And we need a place to be able to put these kids. So aside from the very essential services that are needed for these girls when we encounter them right away. Currently in Ramsey County, we've been using this model for several years in Ramsey County, but every time we come across the court, we're still scrambling to find a safe place, because oftentimes home is not that safe place, and we've learned that JDC is not that safe place for them. It's not the appropriate place. We're charged with investigating and prosecuting people who commit crimes, and sexual trafficking is a crime. And we need the help and support and we need to show support to our victims that are encountered to have successful prosecutions. So I'd like to, I guess, just reiterate again what Sergeant Snyder and County Attorney Choi said, that, you know, this is obviously the morally right thing to do, but we're going to be having a problem as we go about teaching this victim-centered approach in the state of Minnesota, and these victims are going to be encountered again weekly on a weekly basis. They are. We need a place to put them. We need a place that where they can be safe and they can feel safe, so that we can investigate these crimes and successfully prosecute them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And next, Nikki Beasley, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nikki Beasley, and I'm the Director of Programs at Breaking Free in right here in St. Paul. Victims of human trafficking are especially vulnerable to the debilitating physical and psychological symptoms of trauma resulting from their repeated, intrusive, and long-term abuse. Providers working with this population, like myself, emphasize that trauma recovery is critical to a victim's ability to repair and regain his or her life. Minor victims of sex trafficking are frequently in need of services, including out-of-home placement. The most pressing need is safety. In addition, they need emergency housing, basic medical assistance, food, clothing, and legal services. We as providers are advocating for residential facilities in which these victims can receive support, comprehensive services, and a start on the path to recovery. We recognize that these minors meet the federal statutory definition of a minor victim of sex trafficking, and therefore they deserve the humanitarian protections called for under the law. Specialized and intensive care is needed to ensure long-term stability and exit out of the life. We know that these programs need to be safe, trauma-informed, population-specific, and adequately funded. Furthermore, programs currently housing sex traffic victims, such as runaway and homeless youth shelters, detention facilities, and group homes, need additional training and access to appropriate resources to better serve this population. The future safety and stability of this vulnerable population of victims rests on our ability to provide a safe space in which they can recover from the trauma of their trafficking situations and be given a chance at a new life free from exploitation. On behalf of Breaking Free and many of the victims that are here in this room, we thank you for your time.
Is there another testifier?
Yes, I'd like to introduce an amazing young woman and a survivor, Valentina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's critical to have supportive services and safe housing built around the dynamics of prostitution, especially for minors. Neither one is more important than the other. You cannot just answer the demand for one need and expect that alone to be able to solve our problem of prostitution. The mental and physical toll of prostitution cannot be fixed overnight. It takes a combined effort of many special services with staff who are well-trained and well-aware of our situations that us women and girls have been through. The road or life of prostitution is both tragic and traumatizing. With that, the road to becoming a survivor can be just as painful of a battle. We need a huge support system, stability, and structure, somewhere that we feel safe. Safe, supportive, structured housing is a huge piece to this puzzle. Without housing, us women and girls will go back to what we know or be found by our traffickers. Prostitution is not something that we choose. It's forced, even if it's due to lack of other choices. The problems and effects of prostitution is very real, and it's time for Minnesotans to step up and set an example to our nation to fight back and show that we are not further going to allow us women and girls like myself and others in this room to be victimized any longer. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We're very happy to see you. And see someone that's been successful overcoming what happened to them. With that, I think we're that's the final testifier, and so what I want to do is we're going to come back when we get done here today, or this afternoon, we're going to have come back at 6 p.m. in room 118 for questions and amendments or whatever, and vote. Well, this bill will be laid over. In fact, all the bills will be laid over for possible inclusion, except the one. So thank you for your testimony, and we're going to take this bill back up later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, so 118 in the Capitol. There's lots of committees going on tonight, so it's going to be very, very difficult.
We can get a room.
Representative Atkin. Again, members, there's going to be a lot of amendments for this committee, and we'll deal with those amendments. So we're just going to get the presentation of the bill and the witnesses, and I would move House File 779. He recommended to pass and referred to the Ways and Means Committee. So, and if folks would hold the noise down a little bit, we could. Thank you for fighting. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of author's amendments that I'd like to have go on the bill whenever it's appropriate. If you want to put those on at the beginning so we're talking about the bill in the way that that we'd like to present it, that would be fine. If you'd like
to present. Why don't we do that? So where are the amendments?
And the author's amendments, Mr. Chairman, are the A5 and the A6 amendments.
You want to do the
bill? Oh, Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill. And I'll move the amendment.
Okay. So Representative Abler moves the bill, and he also moves A5 and A6, which get the bill in the form of the author.
And Mr. Chair, we've got just kind of a technical, if we could move the A5 independently. Because there is a slight oral amendment that we need to make to the A5.
So, Representative Abler moves the A5 amendment. Representative, do you want to explain the oral amendment? We need to.
Sure, I'll walk through the oral amendment. Perhaps the maker of the motion would be kind enough to incorporate it once I've referenced it. The hospitals raised a slight concern about the A5 amendment, so we put in a little bit of language that we think satisfies them, and that is on line 1.10. After the word hospital, insert the words existing in the area. So to repeat that, after hospital on line 1.10, insert the words existing in the area.
Representative Abler, would
I'll incorporate that. I think that's a friendly amendment, Mr. Chair. I spent a lot of time on this amendment. I think that it makes it better.
We have the A5 amendment as amended. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the A5 amendment is that adopted and then as amended. And Representative Liebling has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just as I'm looking at this, actually, this amendment for the first time, on what, line 1.9, it says, notwithstanding, comma. And usually when you say notwithstanding, it says notwithstanding something. So I just wonder if that needs clarification, Representative Atkins, or just tell us what you're trying to do.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Atkins.
We just like the word notwithstanding. But no, it's notwithstanding the language immediately above it is my understanding of that. And so if you read the previous sentence, that's what it's notwithstanding. I hate that word, actually, Representative Liebling, but it's a reference to the line immediately above.
Representative Lee Wing is it.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't want to be too picky here. It's just, you know, when we're putting things in law, we want people later on to be able to read them without context and understand what they mean. Maybe the word however would be, is the word you're looking for there. But it's up to you, Representative Atkins. Well, I won't say any more about it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I know that the summer advisor has worked very hard, and they may have a purpose for that. So, but I'll discuss with the revisor's office whether however might be a better. And we've got another stop or so. But I appreciate the suggestion.
Okay. So, Okay, and then what was the next one? The A6?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A6.
Representative Abler moves the A6 amendment. Would you describe that, Representative Abler or Representative Atkins?
But, Mr. Chair, if we might, there is a slight tweak on that one that Ms. Cleveland, I believe, has the language for on line 2.16. And if she's comfortable sharing that, I'd appreciate it.
Ms. Cleveland.
Mr. Chair and members, the oral amendment was on page 2, line 16, delete create and insert that creates, and after the first incentives, use, insert to use.
Mr. Chair, when that gets repeated, I'll incorporate that.
Could you just repeat that,
sure.
Ms. Cleveland?
To the A6, page 2, line 16, delete create and insert that creates, and after the first incentives in that sentence, insert to use.
To use?
So it would read, the line would read, either require an enrollee to use or that creates incentives to use, comma.
So, Representative Abler,
I incorporate that, Mr. Chair.
Incorporate that into the A6 amendment, and now the A6 amendment.
And Mr. Chairman, the A6, we don't have complete peace in the valley yet, but that's what we're striving for, and there's several elements in the A6 that seek to achieve that, as we've listened to some who've raised concerns about the bill. It's all right with you, Mr. Chairman. I've got Mr. Munson-Regala here from the department who can do a brief walkthrough of the A6 amendment for you and kind of talk to you about which pieces of it we brought together with the various stakeholders.
Mr. Munson-Regala.
Mr. Chair, members, Manny Munson-Regala from the Minnesota Department of Health. The A6 reflects conversations and feedback from the dental providers, insurance providers, the indemnity carriers, and the Council of Health Plans, as well as the hospitals and the advocates, and we thank them all for their feedback. If you want to walk through 1.1 through 1.7, those were suggested technical amendments to clarify what our intent was with respect to the bill. Starting at 1.9, this was intended to clarify that the rules we were talking about applied to pediatric dental. I know that Representative Loeffler had suggested inclusion of the word pediatric at one of our stops, so that might be something you may want to do here. From 1.16 to 1.23, again, those are a number of technical changes suggested to clarify what provisions we were thinking about when we had our original draft. Starting at 1.23, all on to 2.9, that's a new version of the content on the marketing standards that are to apply to all products. The intent is to make sure that marketing standards are non-deceptive and do not result in discouraging sick people from enrolling in a plan. Starting at 2.10 to 2.13, this was intended to accommodate the concerns of those carriers who rent networks from other carriers, that network adequacy standards should be the responsibility of the entity that actually creates the network. That made sense to us. We accepted that suggestion. 2.15 is the beginning with the oral amendments we talked about. This is language is about talking about when you have to have network standards. We again have the language around does not manage owner contract, so that's the intent to take care of the rental situation. We did have one concern at the department that you not have multiple small subsidiary companies that that you always just used to rent network to evade compliance with the statute. So we included a aggregate requirement that if it got to a certain size, you now become too big to be ignored. So that was the logic there. 2.22 to 2.26 requires that folks who rent their networks to other entities must submit the copy to us for approval for the purposes of ensuring that, in fact, they are the entity agreeing to take responsibility for compliance with the. We just want to be sure we understood who was going to be responsible for complying with network provisions. 2.27 to 2.34 reflects technical changes that the carriers suggested to make it clear, particularly to align with the Affordable Care Act's definition of what were required essential health benefits. 2.35 is to make sure, and I believe that's in the
policy section.
Yep. So that we're going to be getting data from the plans on quality improvement measures. This language is to make sure that we don't end up in duplicative standard gathering. That that if there is data that's already being provided, we don't ask for it twice. In 3.2, we embed the network rental provision again. In 3.6, the plan suggested that if they were accredited, that should be an acceptable satisfaction of the quality improvement measure. Accreditation is a process by which you as a carrier go through a extensive 2 to 3 year review. I believe someone from UREC here is going to be talking a little bit more about the accreditation process. We were okay with accreditation being a form of a deemer, that if you were accredited, you would satisfy the requirements, but we wanted it to be at the highest level of accreditation. Or I know that I understand that UREC accredits in certain areas, in the 5 core areas where we believe it is material to the concept. Section 14 at 3.25 again deals with the requirement of the Affordable Care Act that essential health benefits include pediatric dental. This was intended to clarify what requirements applied to pediatric dental as long as they were part of the essential health benefit package. And that is the A6. Oh, I'm sorry. One more material element, 4.4. Since we are now going to be articulating new network standards in this bill, and I think that might be a typo. I'll have to go back and look. We didn't need the existing network standards. So if we were going to replace the network standards with the network standards in this bill, we wouldn't need the existing ones, but I think that might be 6.14, so I will have to check.
He's checking that, Mr. Chairman. We'd be happy to take questions or concerns, but that's a walkthrough of the amendment, and in its entirety, it was an effort to take those concerns and address them that some of the stakeholders had raised.
Okay, any questions on the A6 amendment? Well, Representative Wofford.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Ramallah. You did mention how I had in an earlier stop defined limited scope dental plans as limited scope pediatric dental plans, just because I felt like at first, I'd never heard of limited scope dental plans. I didn't know what we're referring to when the Affordable Care Act specifies it to pediatric, and I'm just wondering if on the next stop, I don't want to mess with it. You've got it in a whole bunch of different places with lots of language in here. But I just do think it just makes it clearer, because otherwise people who are looking for dental insurance may think this applies to them, and it obviously doesn't unless you're under age 19 or 18 or whatever the cutoff is.
Representative Ackley.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I don't think there was an intent to drop that. It was just one of those things as we were drafting with the revisor's office, and we'll take that as a friendly suggestion to do in the, assuming the committee's understanding of that and okay with that. I believe did we get sent to us, if we passed today, to Ways and Means? Is that our next
one? We're going to Ways and Means.
All right, fair enough. So, Representative Loeffler, that'll be an opportunity, unless there's an objection by this committee, to take back that language.
Okay, any other questions on the A6th Amendment? I don't see any, so all those in favor of the A6th Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
So the A6 and A5 amendments are adopted as, and I think they were both amended a little, amended. Why don't you now present the whole bill as amended, as briefly as possible.
And I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, I know, at least my sense is that there's a considerable amount of crossover between this committee and the Health Policy Committee. And so what I'll ask Mr. Unsen-Ragala to do, he had a presentation that he went through at great length, I think, in the Policy Committee. My guess is that he's best situated to walk through the bill briefly, and then we'll circle back for any questions or concerns that members may have, if that's all right with the chair and members. All right. Yep. I'm going to turn it over to Manny.
Mr. Unsen-Ragala.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill is intended to do a number of things. The first and most important thing is to ensure that the consumer protections that individuals have are the same no matter where you buy your product, whether you buy it from the exchange, outside the exchange, from a walk-up kiosk, from a storefront agent's office, it will be the same set of protections. The areas of consumer protection that are included in the bill include a number of key ones from our perspective. The first one being the requirement that if you're a consumer, no matter where you go, you have the ability to purchase a product at different metal levels. So we're asking the plans that if you offer a product, you must offer them at the option of silver and gold. The second area of consumer protection we want to be the same across the entire marketplace is the marketing standards that apply to how you sell the product. There are existing marketing standards today. They're slightly different between those applicable to HMOs and insurance companies. We're taking this opportunity to have one standard for all companies and just as importantly for the members' purposes, one regulator. Commerce will be responsible for enforcing all the marketing standards throughout the marketplace. The third substantive consumer protection we're suggesting as a common standard is there are certain information disclosures that are required for plans sold within the exchange. That information is going to be used by consumers to make a decision on whether or not they want to purchase a particular product. We believe that information may be useful for consumers no matter where they purchase their product, and we would like to share that same information with consumers no matter where they purchase.
Representative Grunhagen, do you have a question?
Did you want to, I've got a number of questions, so do you want to wait till tonight to deal with those more?
If it's just a clarifying question.
I don't have too many clarifying questions, to say the truth. Mine go a little bit more expansive on the bill. So I could wait for tonight if you put, and then you can get through the rest of your bill. So, but I appreciate being kept on front of the list. Thank you.
So, Mr. Unsen-Ragala, if you could continue.
There are
a few more minutes, though.
Yes. So I'll just highlight the two more remaining sort of substantive sections we would highlight for the committee's attention are network adequacy. I believe I had the pleasure of explaining network adequacy once to Representative Mack. And that's the concept that if you buy a plan with a network, that there be access to care. So we want to take our existing standards that are applicable to HMOs and extend them to the marketplace. The last substantive protection that we're trying to extend is a requirement around service areas, and that's where plans market their products. We want to be sure that service areas be at least the size of a county, but if you want to write a service area smaller than a county, you need to get approval from the Commissioner of Health, and in so doing, you need to demonstrate that you don't design the service area in such a way as to be discriminatory or focus on excluding people with health disparities or health or worse health outcomes. We essentially want to make sure that if you want to write part of Ramsey County, you don't just write Mac Groveland and Skip Rondo, for example. For those in Ramsey County who know what I'm talking about. But that's the kind of the logic of is to be sure that service areas aren't designed to do the functional impact of redlining. That's the high-level concept of our bill. Oh, I'm sorry. Last two sections, quality assurance and accreditation, we've talked a little bit about it. I know that one of the representatives from one of the accrediting entities will be here to talk more about what accreditation means. Accreditation ensures that companies are engaged in a process of continuous improvement and quality. We are actually curious to see what we can leverage from the work companies do around accreditation. That's not part of our concept yet, other than the waiver, but that's certainly a dialogue that will continue with the accrediting entities and carriers.
Right on time, I guess. Mr. Barsh, were you going to make a comment?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I represent Medic. I'm also here today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Just to say, as this bill's moved through the process, we appreciate the work of the author and the agencies to help resolve some issues. We do agree with the agency's objective of applying a uniform and consistent standard. Our concern has been that standard is a workable one, not an overly aggressive one. There's a few areas of the bill that we're still trying to work through with them. I'm confident and hopeful that we can. But just want to recognize our support of that effort to date and appreciate the A5 and A6 as a reflection of that work.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Barsh. And we have one other testifier on another bill that has to talk right now, and then he's going to leave. So thank you for your presentation. We'll see you again at 6 o'clock.
Sounds good. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. 118 Capital. Don Iles is here from Anoka County Human Services Director, and he's going to wants to talk about House File 869 because he can't come back to see you.
Good morning, welcome. Mr. Chair and members. My name is Don Iles. I am the Anoka County Human Services Division Manager. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, which, as you know, is a voluntary membership association of all 87 Minnesota counties. I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today. House File 869 represents one of AMC's top priorities for this legislative session and is part of our overall property tax relief package. This bill is a priority for urban, suburban, and rural counties across the state of Minnesota. Currently, counties pay for all health care costs for county jail inmates. This includes medical care provided within the jail, on an outpatient basis, and on an inpatient care basis. There is no state or federal reimbursement currently for this growing cost. Over the past decade, the inmates of our jail have required more and more costly care for chronic diseases, for mental illnesses, and for communicable diseases. Under the 1965 federal law that created Medicaid, anyone entering a state prison or a county jail lost Medicaid eligibility. The reasoning at that time was that states and local governments had historically taken responsibility for inmate health care costs, so the federal state Medicaid plan should not be needed. However, an exception to that general rule opened up in 1997 when the Department of Health and Human Services wrote to state Medicaid directors saying inmates who leave state or local facilities for treatment in local hospitals can get their bills paid by Medicaid if they are otherwise eligible. In addition to those incarcerated, those on probation or parole or under house arrest were among those who could participate. So far, six other states have taken advantage of the 1997 ruling, and four others are considering it. Counties in Minnesota would like to access to this federal reimbursement to cover this inpatient portion of our jail health care costs. This is particularly important right now, as many of our inmates will likely be considered to be newly eligible under Medicaid expansion, which means the federal government will pay for 100% of those costs through 2019. The inpatient hospitalization costs that counties pay for incarcerated offenders is rising and is a highly unpredictable and difficult to manage portion of our overall jail health costs. As you can well imagine, the cost for a single inmate that is admitted to a hospital for a significant period of time can be extremely problematic. These costs are particularly challenging to small rural counties because of the impact on the county's overall budget. For example, in St. Louis County, inpatient hospitalization costs for this population have varied significantly over the past several years. In 2010, St. Louis County's inpatient hospital costs were $315,000. The very next year, in 2011, that expense dropped to $202,000. The expense dropped further in 2012 to $170,000. This unpredictable fluctuation in county costs in St. Louis County likely mirrors what transpires in every county in the state. The overwhelming majority of the cost to provide medical care to jail inmates will remain with the counties even if this bill becomes law. Counties are required today to pay for care within the jail facility and will continue to be responsible for any cost for medical care of inmates that are provided either in the jail or on an outpatient basis. We believe that House File 869 allowing the state of Minnesota to draw down federal medical assistance dollars will be of great assistance to all 87 counties in the state. We are very pleased that we have a bipartisan group of co-authors on this bill, including you, Mr. Chair, and other members of this committee. We thank you for your support, and certainly I would be happy to answer any questions now or later this evening.
Okay, we're going to have to go into recess, and but I would like to say hello to Commissioner Carter.
Thank you very much.
From Anoka County as well.
Ramsey
County.
Just wishes he's Anoka.
Which is fine.
So, members, we're going to recess until 6 p.m., and we will meet at 6 p.m. in room 118 at the Capitol. But before we recess, would anybody like to...
Mr. Chair, so moved.
Representative Abler moves the minutes of March 19th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of...
Sure, yeah, I'll take them back and I'll bring them back.
By saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are... approved. And we are in recess. I'll call the meeting back to order, and we're going to start with Representative Clark and House File 1445, which we have not had any testimony in yet. So, and I would move House File 1445. The recommended to pass, and ultimately we'll just lay it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a short amendment as well. It's the A1 amendment.
Okay. Yeah, I would move the A1 amendment. Would you, Representative Clark, describe that for us?
Yeah, that amendment just clarifies that we're talking about organizations plural rather than organizations singular that are eligible for the grants. Just technical, basically. But I can explain the whole bill.
Okay. Any discussion of the A1 amendment? I don't see any. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So the A1 amendment is now part of the bill, adopted as part of the bill. Representative Clark.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know you've got a lot on your plate tonight, so we'll try to be brief. Got a couple witnesses, but just members, there's been, you know, increasing attention to the impact that the home environment has on illnesses and that are problems today, including things like asthma, learning and behavioral disorders, brain damage, allergies, injuries, poisonings, lung cancer due to contaminants in the home. And it's a statistic is that I've seen is Americans spend about 90% of their time indoors, and most of that is in our homes. And working with people to improve the healthy environment of our homes will improve our lives, and it's really an important issue today. I can report to you that the Minnesota Department of Health and others have been meeting from around the state since 2012 to develop a healthy home strategy for the state of Minnesota. And this bill just begins the implementation of that plan. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask the first witness to describe a little bit about that, starting with Zach Hansen.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Zach Hansen. I'm the Environmental Health Director for St. Paul Ramsey County Department of Public Health. I'm here this evening on behalf of the local Public Health Association of Minnesota, which represents city, county, and tribal public health departments across the state. Our experience in St. Paul and other cities in Ramsey County has been that there's a strong connection between health and housing. We've worked hard over at least two decades to address childhood lead poisoning using both secondary and primary prevention tactics. We've also worked on radon, asthma, mold, chemical, and injury prevention. And we've learned that it makes more sense to approach these issues from a comprehensive whole house approach rather than one by one. Our experience in healthy homes began with a HUD grant, federal funding, in 2006 in partnership with Minneapolis when we explored the healthy homes approach for children with severe asthma. And those children generally use the hospital emergency room for primary care and miss a lot of school. Our Healthy Homes approach looked at 163 houses occupied by kids with severe asthma, went in and tried to address environmental exposures or environmental triggers of asthma, and tried to get kids a proper night's sleep and reduce asthma attacks. Now, while that focus was on reducing environmental triggers of asthma, when we were in the home, we also looked at issues like lead and radon, mold, chemical, safety exposures, and found that we could reduce those risks as well as addressing asthma. Now, the asthma results were impressive. We found statistically significant improvements in child health through reduced onset of asthma with more days in school and fewer ER visits. So we had healthier kids, we had reduced health costs, and we had more days in school. Now, last year, we were one of seven communities across the state that received funding from the State Health Department for similar projects. And those projects across the state, including the 26 properties we were able to work in, were starting to show that strategy is an efficient and effective use of local resources. Federal funding was cut and led to a discontinuation of that work in 2012. We know there's a clear connection between housing and health. Healthy homes are dry, clean, well-ventilated, pest-free, contaminant-free, safe, and maintained. And a comprehensive approach at the local level to work with homeowners and landlords can address these risks comprehensively, and we have found at the local level it's more efficient. Now, I know that you're interested in return on investment that the state may make in working on healthy homes, and there's folks from the State Health Department that can address this information on a statewide basis. From the local level, I can tell you from the human side that there's a return on that investment. In our lead hazard control program, we've been successful to reduce the incidence of elevated blood lead levels in kids by taking a primary prevention approach. That means that children that would be exposed to lead or that were exposed but then an intervention occurred have a greater likelihood of being smarter and leading a more productive life. Last year, we had 233 kids in Ramsey County that tested over the level that the CDC considers as a point for intervention. And by working with those families, and in some cases the houses they live in, to reduce lead exposure, these kids face better futures. Similarly, our limited healthy homes work has allowed us to demonstrate that low-cost interventions with families in their homes can reduce the use of emergency departments by children with asthma and can increase their time spent in school. LPHA supports policies that promote the early intervention to reduce lead hazards and other risks in the home before children are exposed. We concur with the recommendations of the state's Healthy Home Strategy, and we support that work. This bill, House File 1445, takes us in that direction, and we're pleased that it includes state-administered grants to local public health to continue this work, as well as continued funding for continued surveillance of children with elevated blood lead levels. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. So the next testifier, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Newman. I am the Executive Director of Sustainable Resources Center. We do safe, healthy, and energy-efficient housing. As the previous witness described, Healthy Homes Approaches uses well-documented, evidence-based, cost-effective interventions to address housing-related health hazards such as lead poisoning, asthma triggers, radon, and injury prevention. Unhealthy housing is very costly. Current consequences of unhealthy housing are embedded in our health and education systems, affecting both the costs and the outcomes that we get. The future costs will be seen in increased medical expenses, lost productivity, and reduced incomes. In 2011, SRC, the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, the Family Housing Fund, Minnesota Housing Partnership, and the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, with support from the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota Foundation, began planning for a statewide alliance for healthy homes and communities. The alliance now has 82 members. Last year, the alliance partners and the Minnesota Department of Health traveled around the state to hear what people thought should be in the Healthy Homes Strategic Plan and what the alliance should be doing to support their work. Participants in these meetings included public health agencies, affordable housing developers, community planners, community action programs, building and code officials, local governments, contractors, early childhood educators, health insurers, and foundations. Today, we have a strategic plan, and we have people from all around the state from many sectors who want to address unhealthy housing in their communities. This bill addresses four primary needs identified in the MDH plan that are also priorities for the alliance. The first is lead poisoning prevention. In 2012, the Centers for Disease Control concluded that there is no safe level of lead for children, and that levels of lead we used to think were safe can cause irreversible brain damage. Meanwhile, the CDC funding for the state lead poisoning prevention programs was cut by 95% and is now gone from the state's budget. In last year, 3,000 Minnesota children who were tested had lead levels above the new CDC level of concern. This bill will keep state-level monitoring and case management assistance in place while expanding the capacity of local public health agencies to intervene when children with elevated lead levels are found. The second area is information, training, and technical assistance. Stakeholders identified needs for trusted sources of information, both general and specialized training in healthy homes and technical assistance. Those needs included identifying home hazards, correcting hazards safely, public education materials, and model programs. We also heard loud and clear that these services need to be available by telephone and by mail, not just in electronic formats, in order to reach the populations most at risk. Three is support for local leadership. The Healthy Homes model changes how we provide public health, healthcare, and housing-related services, working across sectors on the community level. Every corner of Minnesota has stakeholders who are interested in working better together. Those cross-sector efforts need grant support for planning, implementation, and evaluation. And the fourth area is support for MDH leadership. MDH leadership across state agencies, across sectors, and in support of local action is vital. This leadership includes developing standards for home health and safety inspections, for corrective measures, and coordination with state and local agencies around asthma, lead, radon, injury prevention, and other healthy homes issues. There is a great deal more information available about healthy homes issues and about the impact on Minnesota of unhealthy housing conditions. The Minnesota Department of Health has been investigating this and working on this for a couple of years, and someone from the department is available if you have specific questions on those issues. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Mr. Newman or the Department of Health? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony. Does this program overlap with any federal or state program? I mean, like HUD's Healthy Homes program? How do you work together with them?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. There is some HUD money coming into Minnesota. The Department of Health has a HUD Healthy Homes grant, Hennepin County has a HUD Healthy Homes grant, and Minneapolis has a Healthy Homes grant. Those grants are for production of healthy housing. They're not for the kind of education, technical assistance, and training that this is that we're talking about here. And they're limited to those geographic regions, and they'll run out. You know, there were 18 Healthy Homes grants given by the feds in 2011. We were lucky to get three of them in Minnesota. I don't think we're going to get three out of 18 next time around. So we need, you know, HUD's there, but it's limited and not really available for these things.
Okay. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. See, I was just looking up the HUD's Healthy Home Demonstration, the program, and it does say that they do work on assessments of the diseases such as asthma and mold, mm-hmm. Carbon monoxide, and lead poisoning and lead paint. And also it looks as to intervention methods. So it does seem to be duplicate what Representative Clark's bill is. So I'm just curious, with your statement, you said that the funds from the federal fund just go to new housing necessarily, but according to some of the research I hear, it does go to some of the research and assessments and prevention measures for the healthy HUD's Healthy Home Program.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, HUD money, if I didn't make myself clear, I apologize. HUD money is used to intervene in homes. It is used to do assessments and interventions in houses. What we're talking about here is the work that needs to get done. So yes, it does those things, and it does those things in the jurisdictions that have those grants for the next year and a half that they have those grants. What we're talking about here is training, technical assistance, and local support for grants to do the kinds of community-level organizing and cross-sector work that that Mr. Hansen described, and that has been happening around the state happened last year with support from the Department of Health with the federal dollars. So this is getting people together to figure out, how do we address problem properties in our community? How do we address the issues that we find? And we have a public health nurse who goes into a house, and she's in there to maybe do a well child visit, and she finds out that there's mold, and that the child has asthma, and that there's asthma triggers in the home, that there's a pest infestation. Where does she go? Who does she talk to? How does she get support for that family so that we can keep that kid healthy and keep that family healthy? That's the kind of community level organizing that we need to do to get the health people and the housing people and the other resources available in that community to address these community problems, and to find ways that they can make those resources available, to not be dependent only on HUD dollars to come and go, but to figure out how we can make this part of how we work together. It's about Healthy Homes is about changing what we do. And, you know, not doing something, I mean, it's not like totally different. This is, how do we fix a house? How do we address housing hazards, housing-related health hazards? So I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Somewhat, yes, certainly does. Then could you, do you know the amounts of those grants then from the federal government for these programs? And you say they will run out. Can you give me the date that they will run out?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I can't give you precise amounts. I can be relatively close because we're involved as a provider in both of the Minneapolis grant, I think, is $1.8 million for 3 years, and it started in September of 2011. The Hennepin County grant is about the same amount, $1.8 million, and again, it started in the fall of 2011. It's a three-year program. And I believe the Department of Health has a Healthy Homes grant as well that was on the same cycle, so that will end in 2011. And these are targeted to very specific programs in very specific communities. They are not available on a statewide level.
Yeah, Mr. Hansen, do you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think what the state's strategic plan calls for, besides the opportunity to do some direct intervention through grants to local governments, is a need that serves the entire state. It calls for creating statewide resources, and as Mr. Newman said, whether that's by telephone or but some means for whether it's housing contractors or local public health agencies or others to get resources and information that they can use throughout the state. The HUD grants you refer to are pretty competitive on a nationwide basis and typically will go to a large urban area for a limited period of time. And while they may be substantial for that period of time, they don't provide that sustained resource that we could use in Minnesota throughout the state. So all of the agencies that are part of the local public health association throughout the entire state would have access to resources that would result from the work of this bill.
Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Clark, and your testifiers. I think this is important work. It's good preventative work in terms of preventing problems that are pretty serious, especially in the lives of children. The one thing that I'm hoping, since you're the chair of the Housing Committee, is that you'll also, with your limited resources, look at how you can finance these improvements, because I know many of the communities across the state where, you know, if one out of three houses has radon, you know, lead paint, isn't anything built before, what, 1970-something, is that a lot of houses are still underwater, so they can't get traditional home improvement loans in order to deal with it. And nothing is worse than feeling like you and your children are living in an unhealthy environment, and there's no way to finance the improvements that are really needed. And I'm hoping that we can work with, you know, HUD and all the resources that you know more about than I do in housing, because identifying the problem is just the first step. And the second step is making sure we have some resources to do that. And for houses that are underwater, it's really hard. You just can't get home improvement loans because they just won't bank on negative equity.
Any other questions? I don't see any. So, Representative Clark, do you have a final comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just ask for your support for this legislation, and I want to say to Representative Loeffler, yes, we're very much aware that we need to make sure that our Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and others that use some of the rehab loans and other kinds of resources available to them will help deal with some of the work that's discovered and diagnosed and needs to happen as a result of this work. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Clark. And House File 1445 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
As amended.
Committee members.
And Representative Loeffler, are you ready to? We heard from one of your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing a testifier who couldn't be here tonight to testify squeezed in, because this is a high-priority bill of the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the bill is being heard in the Senate tonight as well. So I'm not sure, it doesn't appear that Commissioner Tony Carter from Ramsey County will be here to testify to it, but I think if you are listening to the commissioner from Anoka, you know the big effort. I do have one oral amendment that has been suggested by the state agencies that I would like to add on to the bill, Mr. Chair. But first I'll move the bill for possible consideration. And the oral amendment that has been suggested is on page 2, on line 2.2, strike county and add entity with jurisdiction over the inmate. And I can tell you that, just to remind you, this will help just by changing these words, will also help make this be a budget saver potential for the Department of Corrections in the state, because they also have people who are in confinement who sometimes are required to leave the facility to get needed medical assistance care. And as we put together our budget, we're going to have to wrestle with a number of issues related to who pays the match and how does this all work. But this will definitely, I'm told by the agencies, clarify that.
Yeah. Ms. Cleveland, could you repeat that amendment? I think I've got strike county and put down entities with jurisdiction over the inmate.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you don't need to. Yeah. So any questions on that oral amendment? We have to vote on that. You want to incorporate that into your bill?
I could incorporate that into the bill. We don't even have to vote on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Association of Minnesota Counties has been working for, 5 to 7 years, it feels like, on trying to figure out how to get people who are in their care, most likely in their jail, eligible for medical assistance for the growing cost of providing health care to those people who have a constitutional right established by the courts to have their care needs met while they're not allowed to be out free and going to their own doctors. And they have found that 6 other states have been able to implement this change and get medical assistance to pay for people who are eligible. When medical assistance was created, the federal government didn't want to pick up the costs that states had for running what we used to call regional treatment centers. And so they excluded all institutional care from eligibility. And yet we have people who are in jails who are not even found guilty. They may be found innocent, but they can't put up bail, and they may have health costs that require them to transport them to a hospital, and those bills are very high and very unpredictable, as our testifier said this morning. And so this seems like a way for us to get the federal government in partnership with these very expensive health care costs, both at the local level and potentially at the state level in the Department of Corrections. And it will also, I think, help protect our communities and stabilize the health of these people, because we know a significant number of people who are picked up and put into jails have chemical dependency issues, they have mental health issues, they have a variety of challenges. You get them stabilized when they're in jail. You don't want them to walk out without, you know, their prescriptions and being able to continue on with whatever therapy is needed to keep them stable and not acting out. And this will enable and encourage them signing up for medical assistance while they're in the jail. When they're released, then they will be able to continue that care because they'll be eligible, and it'll be less likely that they'll be picked up for inappropriate behavior and thrown back in. And so we think it might have some preventative investments as well. And with that, I'll just be glad to answer any questions.
So, Representative Loeffler, what this would do is allow us to capture some federal dollars to pay part of the cost of these hospital treatments.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Right now, the state and the counties are picking up these costs 100%. And this would allow us to have these inpatient days and the care provided there to be covered by medical assistance, which means 50% federal match.
Okay, and I will say there's one little hook in this thing that I'm going to have to deal with, and we'll have to deal with the administration and people that tell me what the targets are for this. And it's because it saves about $6 million a year in the corrections department and adds about $6 million a year to the Health and Human Services budget. So I know our Representative Loeffler will be glad to join me in talking to leadership about that.
Mr. Chair, I must say that when we worked with the counties and discovered the broader applicability about this, my goal has become a win-win-win, a win for the state in corrections and human services and with the counties who and their property taxes. And Julie Ring from the Association of Counties has just joined me, and I know she's committed to the counties helping us with figuring out those solutions as well.
Ms. Ring, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the cardio tonight. I was in the Senate, literally ran, but I think it sounds like you have the topic covered. So thank you for contributing to my good health.
Okay, are there any questions for Representative Loeffler or Representative McDonald?
Just a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, did you say even if they are found innocent, they can't make bail, so they still need a ride to their medical appointments?
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, I am not an expert on corrections, but my understanding is when someone is being held pending trial, so they because they're not going to be released unless they can put out bail. If they have a medical emergency, they have a massive seizure, whatever, they need to be brought to professional care. That is an obligation under law of the jail.
Representative
McDonald. Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Walfer, but maybe I heard this wrong, but I thought that you said even if they're found innocent and they can't make bail. Is that what you said?
Representative Walfer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative McDonald, what I wanted to remind you is that there are people in jail who are innocent. They just haven't had a chance yet to have their day in the court, and they may be found innocent. But the situation is they're in the jail, and they're not able to just run out to their local doctor or on some other basis.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Juan, I think the idea is these are pre-conviction inmates being held in our county facilities a lot of times, where literally they are being arrested, and a lot of times my wife was supervised in Anoka County Jail. And so you would have pre-convicted individuals that were arrested and incarcerated, and on day one or day two before their first sentencing needed multiple medications and would sometimes be hospitalized. And so these people may not have even had their first appearance before a judge, and they're already being taken with armed transport to a emergency room. So I think there are some instances where someone can literally be picked up out of a situation from the public, brought to jail, and 4 hours later be brought by ambulance to an emergency room.
Okay. Other questions? I don't see any. So with that, Representative Loeffler, we will take House File 869, and it will be laid over for possible inclusion in the final bill and as it was amended.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee.
Okay, what do we need to do? Is Den here? Representative Den?
Probably in 118 waiting for us.
Should we get the joke on here?
No. I was there. It's 5 minutes before the meeting.
Yeah.
Another meeting before
this? Oh, is Alan here? Okay.
Hey, there's Alan.
Representative Alan, we're ready for you.
I know what this is. I can barely make it here. No pressure.
Take so much when you're first. Okay. So, Representative Allen, we'll go back to House File 485, and you had people testify, and I see they're back here. But I think they're back here just for questions, if there are any questions about this. And this is the bill that relates to sexual trafficking of primarily young women. And are there any questions for the testifiers or for Representative Allen? Any discussion of the bill, then? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. Hey, thanks for your good work that you do to help these young ladies, mostly, and probably young children in some cases. But do you work with, if I remember right, there was some testimony from Breaking Free, too. So are you coordinating and working with some nonprofits, too, that also work in this area?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. We do coordinate with other nonprofits that do similar work. For example, if we have a young person that comes to us that's maybe run away and maybe spent some time in a runaway and homeless youth shelter, and she becomes identified as someone who's been trafficked, we would work with that shelter program in providing services for that young girl, whether it's doing some training for the staff or being a support for that young person while she's in shelter.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so is it possible that to get these additional beds, if I remember our discussion and testimony this morning, that it might be a more efficient, effective way working with the nonprofits to expand the number of beds as far as for these exploited individuals?
Whoever, just identify your name.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenhagen. Jeff Bauer, Director of Public Policy of the Family Partnership. What I can tell you is, you know, leading up to this legislative session, myself and a number of others spent the good part of 2 years traveling all over the state, every corner of the state, talking to homeless youth shelters, talking to domestic violence shelters, you name it, and asking the exact same question that you're asking tonight in committee, which is, you know, is there something that exists now that we could use differently, that we could repurpose? And what I can tell you, honestly, is the answer is no. Everywhere we found they're running at capacity, they're struggling just to hold on, to keep the beds going that they have. And so, you know, obviously, as we move forward, if those opportunities arise, we're just as interested in that as anyone, if using what we have rather than building new. But what I can tell you from a really extensive time around the state is it doesn't exist now. We need to build it.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Representative Allen and anyone else that could answer this. Similar to Representative Gruenhagen's, when I was on the Public Safety Committee the last couple of years, we often heard testimony on the women's shelters, the battered women's shelters, and a very important program, state shelters as well, and as to nonprofits. But some of the testimony witnessed that many of them are half empty, so their bed capacity is not full. So would it be prudent for this organization to partner up with the Batters Women's Shelter for bed capacity as opposed to taking $4 million in building a brand new facility to increase their bed capacity? And then the second part of the question, just in case I won't speak on this issue, have you looked at, instead of creating another direct door for this agency, looking at maybe partnering up with the public safety or the human services or the Department of Health, for that matter, a commissioner or director there, rather, that could take on some of these responsibilities instead of creating more programs or more employees, more FTEs, and more costing more money?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for those great questions. I have enjoyed presenting this in front of you in the Public Safety Committee over the past couple of years. Sorry, I'm looking over a chair to see you here.
Smith, Representative Kwan, could you move that chair, please? Thank you.
Much better. All 5'7" of me cannot see over that big chair.
Well, he's a pretty tall target.
Hey, listen here, Zerwas.
So I appreciate the questions. And to answer your first question about the domestic violence shelters, that's something that we also talked quite a bit about when we were developing this model with law enforcement, with advocates, with the folks at Breaking Free and others, and also people around the country who work with children who have been trafficked. And one thing that just the emerging research has shown is that the best place for these children is a place that works specifically with children, and that there are a number of problems that arise when you start mixing them in with adult populations, like a domestic violence shelter. And so we have looked at that option. You know, all I can tell you is the developmental experts in the field have told us that that's not the way to go, that oftentimes smaller venues that feel like homes that can house, you know, 4 to 6 children at a time tend to be the best therapeutically, rather than putting these children in a larger institution and saying sort of these 4 beds are for you. So that's that. To get to your second question in terms of, you know, utilizing an existing director or something like that to coordinate this rather than creating a new position, you know, this is a really comprehensive model, and it's a model that really hasn't been built anywhere else in this country. And so to hold all of the pieces together, there's the public safety aspect, there's the public health aspect, there's the shelter aspect, there's all of the therapeutic services, training, all of that. You know, we really, it's going to be a huge job to handle for a new position. Just one person, to be honest with you. It's a lot to put together, you know, especially in greater Minnesota where we're just starting to have some of the pieces emerge and figure out how to connect them. I think our concern is more that we're not sure that this person's going to have the capacity to do all the work that needs to be done. So we feel comfortable in recommending it. It does need a whole new position.
Mr. Chair?
Representative McDonald.
Just to follow up, Representative Norton. So those eyes. See, just thank you very much. I am grateful for your answer. That is a very wise answer and makes great sense. And thank you for your good work. Let's continue to work hard and pray hard that in years to come we won't need these facilities because we end the sex trafficking here in Minnesota.
Agreed. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. And I did want to follow up in this same line of thinking. I'm totally supportive and am a co-author of the bill and think this is extremely comprehensive and it would be the right thing to do. My question, my concern is we've been given a negative budget target for this committee and the Senate has the same. So we have been hearing bills for weeks and weeks that are heart-wrenching and we have to somehow find a way to do what little bit we can, hopefully find some savings in order to fund some of these things. I guess knowing that, this is very comprehensive. Is there something we can do to scale it down to still move in the direction we need to without doing everything all at once? And I don't expect you to have an answer today, and I know you don't want to hear that. I've been told that on several of my bills, too. Scale it back. It's like, I don't want to scale it back. This, you know. So I understand that. But I guess I would encourage you to help us maybe as we move into to working through these budget targets. I don't want to not pass a bill this year. I want to pass a bill. And if we can't pass this bill, what can we do to keep us moving in the right direction so that next year and the year after and the year after we keep, because I know and persistence pays off in this place, you keep coming back to get what you want. And you know, if we can't do all this, I encourage you to keep coming back and pounding on the table to get what we want. But so you can either answer that or just think about it. But I am concerned looking at the budget targets and looking at this great program, and you know, it hurts. So,
Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Representative Norton. I appreciate that, and I know that's something that I believe that all the parties that are involved in this, I think there's like more than probably 65 or stakeholders, and I'm sure that they will be open to discussing that. So thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I would just say one of those stakeholders in our community are the Nuns of Assisi Heights, and they are the best advocates for this issue that anybody could have. So bring them in and keep them calling, writing.
And Representative Allen, we you and I also need to go talk to the leadership on this particular issue. And I will say he was not down here today, but the police chief in Duluth is very interested in this. Mm-hmm. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I was just downstairs talking to some of your members, many chairs of your caucus, and I raised some of those points. I'm talking about the Ways and Means Committee. We're discussing targets, so I... just so you know, our target is $237 million below the governor in general fund. So just to help people understand, which... so I've been thinking more creatively today since I heard that number yesterday. I thought the Senate would save us, and they're actually worse, $2.8 million more. So I'm glad you're here. I'm a co-author as well. But I've been thinking that we closed 128 corporate foster beds in the last budget when we were saving some money, and there's a phase-out process of that. And it occurs to me that as you look for sites, there's some already built that are vacant or being vacated that it could accommodate. Those are four bedroom places for developmentally disabled and other individuals, and it's just there's somewhere to go with that, perhaps. And they're already in neighborhoods. they, you know, developmentally disabled neighbors don't make very good neighbors. They don't interact a lot of times. Staff comes and goes, and so, but the people are kind of used to that kind of traffic, and so I think they'd be very friendly towards some of your clients who would be actually, you know, maybe a little more. They would be quiet, and you know, maybe they'd, you know, be a little more interactive, perhaps. So just a thought as you go forward with that. So I've been shopping that already through the department, and maybe they'll be open to it. But it's just a thought. So thanks. Okay. And by the way, they're statewide, so they're all over the place.
Representative Allen, you want to give a final comment, and then we'll.
I think everything's been said. I think we've been through it. Many of you have heard this more than once. So, but and I appreciate all your support, and so we'll conclude our presentation. Thank you.
And I want to thank the three that came here earlier today and are still here. I assume the two police officers are back on the street. Yeah. So thank you, and so I will. We'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And thank you again for your testimony. It was very
thank
moving.
You, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
We did have Representative Den here for his bill, but he's also has a bill in another committee at exactly the same time. That's what happens in these 2 weeks that we're in.
Get stacked.
And so we're waiting for Representative Atkins to. We sent somebody up to his office, and he should be down shortly. And that bill, I assume, is going to take a little bit of time.
Good.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I'm a co-author on that bill if you want me to present it, if you just want to move through it. I'm serious.
He should be down. He's up in his office.
Okay.
But if you wanted to start, I could sit there and then I could leave. I want to go home tonight.
Yes, exactly. Your mental health.
I'm going to go out there on this one. And then just submarine. No.
Oh, no.
Since he's I think we should have James.
I should have you pick up a fiction in it.
Dean.
They're looking for him. Dean.
Yeah.
Dean.
It's worse than you thought.
No.
The Lord will.
So just time.
Is the sheet after it?
Sheet. Sounds funny.
Everything dies eventually.
Yeah. That's the original governor.
That's the original. No, the new governor is 107.
Harry, I got a bill before transportation.
Really?
Early.
For 150 below.
And yeah. Tomorrow.
No.
Yeah. Sorry.
Death and tax.
Yeah. Those have been very, so, very fast.
It's worse than you
they
thought.
Didn't pass these out to us.
Oh, they were.
We haven't gotten all
a new one. I have
during
one. I
got same time slot as this one.
You know people.
What's that?
You know people.
Well, I just got it yesterday. We got the revised one. Yes.
Of course, he didn't know if I had the vote, so he held it over.
That's another 100.
What?
What's it all worth?
Right, which is first on the agenda.
Representative Abler, if you would like to start on Den's bill.
Representative Atkins is here. Representative Atkins is
here. Except I'm not
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move whatever bill number this is for a possible inclusion.
House File 927.
And I have some great witnesses, Mr. Chair, so I'll just turn it over to them.
Oh, 927.
Oh, actually, no, these people represented by this legislation are people who are trying to get a second shot at life. They have been convicted of a crime, sometimes serious ones, but they've paid their time, they've served their time, and they're either rehabilitated or trying very hard to stay that way. And if we can help them get a niche in society, they will actually be fine. If we tempt them and put them in challenging places where they can't work and they got nothing, their future is bleak. And so that's why I'm a strong supporter of this. I met some of the individuals, and I'm most impressed with how they deport themselves and their interest in trying to make a new life for themselves. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my witness.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Darrell Lindsay. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Network for Better Futures. I'm joined here this evening with by Jermaine Davis, who's one of the participants in the Network for Better Futures, and we appreciate this opportunity to give testimony in behalf of Bill House Bill 927. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill. In 2007, the network was selected by the state through a competitive bid process to develop and fully evaluate an integrated care model aimed at reducing the economic and social costs of high-risk adults. One-time funding of $1.4 million is needed to complete this pilot, which is already showing early promise. With this funding, a fully funded independent evaluation can be completed. A return on investment analysis can be calculated, and a full accounting of costs of current policies and practices can be completed. This pilot has demonstrated effective ways to reform the costly systems and practices that produce poor results and perpetuate the chaos and cycles of dependency experienced by the high-risk men we serve. By setting high expectations and providing direct access to the resources needed to meet these expectations, housing, behavioral health, primary health care, employment, and life coaching, participants are offered the opportunity to become contributing, productive, and healthy members of society. This pilot is a public health initiative and is addressing serious health, behavioral health, and social issues that affect multiple public systems at the local, county, and state levels. For example, this pilot engages a large group of underserved people, mostly African-American men, with disproportionate rates of chronic diseases. Among 40 men examined over a six-month period at Hennepin Medical Center, 60% had serious or serious and persistent mental illness, 35% were dependent on drugs and or alcohol, and 18% needed treatment for diabetes. In addition, a majority of staff time, life coaching, the counseling, getting men ready to work, and housing supports is focused on dealing with chronic health and behavioral health issues and on providing trauma-informed care techniques to assist men with dealing with these issues. Furthermore, 60% of the pilot participants are fathers, and since most of these pilot participants are working, these fathers are paying their child support and re-engaging with their children. The pilot's integrated care approach also complements and helps build a coordinated care network envisioned under the Affordable Care Act. We introduce and connect all participants to a health home, and we help enroll participants in a health plan and work to keep them enrolled as they move through their income changes. We are also committed to fully developing a pay-for-performance reimbursement model as a way to sustain this model of success financially. We already have a modest pay-for-performance contract with Hennepin County, and we would hope to establish a similar outcome-based reimbursement approach with the Department of Human Services if this funding is approved. Under a pay-for-performance structure, the network is accountable for achieving increased employment, improved health outcomes, increased child support payments, and reduced use of jails and prison. The value of appropriating one-time funding of $1.4 million to complete this demonstration is substantial. The state funds will leverage $3.6 million in other funds, including $1.2 million in earned business income. 120 men will be employed part-time, and 12 full-time jobs will be created. 200 new high-risk men will be enrolled and served, with 200 men being engaged at any one time. An independent evaluation fully funded by Robert Wood Johnson Foundation will be completed and will be using state data sources to complete that evaluation. Effective ways to maintain connections between high-risk adults and primary health care networks will be developed more fully. And the data from the independent evaluation will help inform ways to reduce and control state spending and improve the performance of state programs. The state's investment will help further develop and fully implement a viable pay-for-performance reimbursement model. Again, we thank you for offering us a chance to express our support for this bill. At this time, I'd like to allow Jermaine to make some comments.
Welcome to the committee.
I've been through numerous programs to try to re-engage back into society. I come from Chicago, and the life that I was living in there, it kind of like gave me barriers to seek resources due to gang territories and such like that. So I came to Minnesota in search of a new life. And I was going through program after program after program. And they say, you do this, do this, do this, we'll do that. But it wasn't no help. And so I got lazy. I moved in with a female. You know, some things went down. I went back to jail. And I came back and I was searching again for more resources. And I fell into the network. And I've been in this program for 6 months. And already I have a lease in my name. I got a bank account. I'm engaged right now. I got a child on the way. It's been doing real good things. A lot of opportunities been falling in my lap. And I get to show my gifts and my talents every day, even more. You know, I'm trying to be a public speaker and such. And they give me opportunities to do that, to facilitate groups, because we have support groups. So I'm strengthening in areas that I didn't know I lacked in, because I was so focused on just trying to live life. But I was living life on the wrong side of the tracks. Now that I see what this world has to offer, this enterprises has opened their doors to me and gave me a great of assistance. And it's an honor to be in front of y'all like this, because I remember last time I was in a room like this, I was on trial. So this is kind of funny. So, but a man with no hope is scary. When I have nothing to look forward to, that's when I was, and that was the dangerous. You know, I didn't care about nothing. I had no morals. Now I go to work every day. I pay bills, got to pay rent. You know, I have something to look forward to. And I'm very appreciative. That's why I took the time out of my day, a long day, I should say, you know, to come up here to give y'all this testimony. This really, like, there's not no place where you sign your name and then they get their money and they kick you out of the door. No, if you meet your milestones, you get rewarded for that. You know, that's what's so, you know, unique about this program, because they pay you to do what you supposed to do. So they give you that little buzz and that little nudge, you know, like, if I do this in 6 months, I got this to look for. So instead of thinking about negative stuff, I'm thinking about creating this milestone so I can go to Target and spend this money on this gift card instead of going out of my pocket. So it's real good. I got a debt consolidating plan going on. I'm paying my debt off. I'm paying taxes now. So my future is real bright. And if you would have known me back then, you know, I don't believe, like I said, I would have been on trial. So this is a very great opportunity. I thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I will say that I've visited your facility, I think, twice, and I've been very impressed. And what impresses me more than probably anything is the fact that you got Robert Wood Johnson to... they don't throw their money away, I can tell you that. And the fact that your organization is actually measuring what your outcomes are, that is very important to me, because we have a lot of groups come in here and say they're going to do good things and just give us the money. But this organization actually measures what their outcomes are, and they can show that they're successful. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to one of the testifiers, I guess two questions. My first question, looking at the document you passed out, and I see there's a breakdown of projected revenue sources. And I'm just curious, a lot of times when we have groups come to this committee, you know, the question commonly comes up and is kind of put at a premium in terms of understanding how much of money that you take in goes towards directly to the clients that you're serving, and how much is overhead and admin costs to administer the program. Do you have, I guess, one, could you answer the question what that percentage is in terms of admin overcost or overhead cost? Thank you. And if you have that to provide to the committee at some point, or just to me, I'd be interested to take a look.
Okay. Mr. Chairperson, Representative Mack, thank you for that question. I don't have that data with me at present, but I'd be happy to present that to this committee in the very near future.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, just one more question. How, and Chair Huntley referenced it, measuring your outcomes. How I don't necessarily see that here. How do you guys measure those outcomes? Or is it over a period of time? If you could just shed some light on how that's done in terms of kind of showing the return for the investment that's made and what your outcomes are.
Mr. Lindsay.
Mr. Chairperson, Representative Mack. Basically, I give you one example. We have a small pay-for-performance contract with Hennepin County right now. There are four outcomes that are measured there. One is men getting a lease in their name and maintaining it for a period of time, and there's a one-time payment associated with that. There's another outcome that's measured is that's men getting employment outside of our organization and maintaining it for a period of time. There's a one-time payment for that. There's another outcome of men getting signed up for health insurance and maintaining that for a period of time. Again, one-time payment for that. And then the final one is men are measured over a period of 6 months. If there's no new felony conviction that causes them to return to custody or a technical violation that returns them to custody, there's a one-time payment for that.
Okay. And Representative Den, thank you for coming and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm sorry, I haven't quite figured out how to be three places at one time yet, but I'm working on it and getting better. So I probably couldn't add a whole lot more than what Mr. Lindsay and Jermaine said. I'll also add that in addition to all the things that Jermaine is doing, he's also now a taxpayer. And I think that that's something that we all need to consider when these young men go into, an initiative like the network. It's really about turning their lives around, setting them on the straight path, but it's also about changing the equation. Oftentimes, these are individuals that we as taxpayers pay to either lock up, incarcerate, or make part of the judicial system. And this is a complete 180 degree where they're actually now becoming contributing members to the revenues that the state has for those things that we need to do as far as the state goes. So I'm not going to go through this whole list. It's a late night. I actually also have to get back to another committee meeting. But we're happy to continue to take a few more questions as well, if you'd like.
Are there any questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Davis, I loved your presentation. I saw in you that true joy that reminded me of when my son got his first job and the first paycheck and that wonder of the path you're on. And it's a blessing to see the results of a successful program in the eyes of the participants.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and thank you to the testifiers. And I did jail ministry for over 13 years. And if you get out of jail, go back into the same cycle that you were, and pretty soon they were back in Bible study about 6 months or a year later. So this definitely is a laudable goal that you're doing. And God bless you, and I just pray that you continue to make the right choices. It's easy to make the wrong choices. And thanks for your testimony. But one of the questions I have, the way I understand the program, is that this money is used to help pay for an employment job. Is that correct to the employer?
Lindsay.
Representative, I'm sorry.
Grunhagen.
The money goes for a number of things. It's for housing for the men that we work with. It's for the life coaching services. The life coaches get the men connected to health services, behavioral health services, a number of other things, help them navigate their way. This money will not be used for employment. This is really about the social support services for the men that we are enrolling.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, just a quick pause. So employers don't receive any money from your organization for employing these individuals?
Mr. Chairperson, Representative Grunhagen, no, sir, they do not.
Okay. All right, thank you. That's all.
And they have their own employment, right? Don't you do building teardowns and that sort of thing? Whereas where they get paid to do that, and they have the people that they work with do the work.
Okay.
Mr. Chairperson, that's correct. You may note from the green flyer that we handed out, that is our business enterprise. So right now we operate several work crews. Our work crews do such things as demolition and salvage, groundskeeping. We have a number of contracts with Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis. We do appliance recycling and waste recycling. So we're growing our own enterprise, our own business, but we do look for employers outside of our workforce to employ the men once we help them develop some work skills.
Yep, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for
Representative Dean. Representative Dean, earlier in this committee we looked at, you know, and I think when you look at nonprofits that can partner with the state to help individuals out, I think that's a great partnership, the kind of the idea of a public-private partnership. We had a Safe Harbor in here earlier, and their CEO, their executive director for Safe Harbor, makes roughly $80,000 for the amazing work that they do, and that's what their salary is. As we look through our records here for this group, it looks like the executive director here makes about $250,000, and the other several other executives make over $100,000 a piece. And so I'm wondering, you know, there's a lot of great examples of public-private partnership where the money can really make an impact, but I'm wondering if we have $1.4 million going out to a group, if over $350,000 of that is going to salaries right off the top, if that's the best investment of the state's money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerowitz, I'm not sure where you're looking at, but I wish I was making that kind of money, okay? But what I will do is our president and founder is here. I'll let him speak directly to that.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Steve Thomas, and I'm the president and CEO of the Network for Better Futures. Those numbers, none of those numbers are right. I'd be happy to share with you everyone's salaries. They're all in line with... We use three surveys to set salaries, the United Way, there's two charity guides, and we also have a private service that provides us comparable salary data. But none of those numbers are anywhere near what is actually happening. I'd be happy to share that with you.
Okay. Representative Zerowitz, did you follow up? Okay, then are there any other questions? I don't see any, so... Okay. Oh. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. See, question for, and I didn't hear your name, the testifier. Yes, sir.
Daryl Lindsay.
Mr. Linden. The Lindsay. Pamphlets, pardon?
Lindsay.
Mr. Lindsay, thank you. Your mission statement and your information, just question on your pie graph. I see you have one, your private funding is 1.180,000, so it's 23%. And my question is the counties at 24%. Is that where does that money come from in the counties?
Mr. Chairperson and Representative, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
McDonald.
Those are through pay for performance contract. One is a pay for performance contract with Human Services in Hennepin County. The other funds are coming through paid contract that we have with the county to maintain county lots or other business enterprises that we have with the county. So those are not in the forms of grant. That is earned income.
Mr. Chair,
Representative McDonald.
All right, Mr. Lindsay, so your earned income is at 24%, but then on your portion, which is mustard yellow, says the counties of 24%. Is that up and above the other earned income, which is in the blue section of the pie?
No, the environmental.
Okay, so Mr. Chairperson, Representative McDonald, I'm not looking at the pie chart right now, so I'm not exactly sure what you're looking at there, but... Okay, so the counties is the Human Services pay for performance contract. Also under earned income, there is an environmental services contract that we have with Hennepin County as well. We have two separate contracts with Hennepin County. One is a pay for performance contract. The other is a environmental services contract, and that is for our business enterprise.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative McDonald.
So then it's you could say then the both earned income and the county section of your pie are both earned income. Is that my understanding? Your pay performance on the 24%?
Mr. Lindsay.
Mr. Chairperson, Representative McDonald, that would be correct, yes.
Okay. That's all.
Representative Abler.
Well, maybe I'll just have the last word here. I just wanted to thank, especially Jermaine. I met some of your colleagues nodding at the banquet this year, but maybe you were there and met some other good people. But You know, it's something you said I just wanted to repeat. A man with no hope is scary. And I think that's a compelling statement. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So, Representative Dean, if you want to give some final words, then we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion.
I think this is a good bill. I think it's important that we consider individuals in their lives, and I can't top Representative Abler's comment quoting Jermaine, so I'll leave it at that, and thank you.
Okay. So thank you for your testimony, and House File 927 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And what? Yeah. Representative Atkins. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we've already moved that House File 779, so Representative Atkins, you did give some testimony. You had the two people, Munson Regala and Von Ruden, testify, and if you have more testimony you want to give, or you just want to answer questions? We have a bunch of amendments.
And, Mr. Chairman, we had the good fortune of having a little bit of time in between this morning and this evening. There's one additional amendment, the A7 amendment, that I would now consider an author's amendment. If you'd be so kind as to move the A7, we would like to have that incorporated into the bill as well, and believe that all parties are in agreement, all of the stakeholders are in agreement relative to the usefulness and appropriateness of that that language as well.
Mr. Chair.
So I would move the A7 amendment. And if you would describe the amendment.
I will, Mr. Chairman. I do want to note also this was actually drafted to the first engrossment, and I suspect, though, that with the help of our very able staff, that they can, as I read the amendment and go through it briefly, that they can probably find the appropriate place in which to insert the language. It's simply that for annual enrollment periods, the health carriers offering individual health plans must limit annual enrollment in the individual market to the initial and open enrollment periods for the Minnesota marketplace. Nothing in this section limits the application of special or limited enrollment periods. Quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, I don't know precisely what it's designed to accomplish, but both sides like it, and therefore I do too.
Yeah. Would the staff describe the oral amendment we have to make to this amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, on line one of the A7 amendment, it should say the second engrossment, and on line two, it should we should delete 8 and insert 11 after line 11.
Okay, so it would still be page 9, line 11. Okay. Are there any questions on the amendment as amended? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. Yeah, Representative Atkins, I just think this is a wise and prudent amendment. I think it'll incentivize. you thought,
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw the amendment immediately.
All right, I won't say it.
Praise the bill.
I'm sorry.
I tried to give you a compliment.
I appreciate that.
What? All right. Let's start over.
What it'll do, I believe, is it'll keep people from buying health insurance after they have a problem, which is what we don't want, I think, in this. And it's the same idea with homeowners insurance. Well, my house is on fire. I'll go, buy some homeowners insurance. And ultimately, we want people to participate in the market and and purchase the health insurance that they need. And I believe this goes a long ways towards incentivizing them to do that. Thank you, Mr. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And thanks for having a sense of humor.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
and not knowing either, like the author, exactly what this works. I just hope this doesn't work against someone, for example, who has to go off their parents' policy at age 26, but they're still in grad school, and so they have to shift into an individual policy and not make them wait till the next open enrollment. I don't see anything in here that says, you know, except when there's a life change or something like that. But
I can shed light.
Representative Atkins or Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Mr. Chairman, Andy Munson-Ragala, that's exactly the kind of special circumstance that would be contemplated so under this amendment. So if someone leaves their parents' policy because they age out, they're 26 in a day, that would be an opportunity for them to purchase an individual policy.
Yep. Okay. And Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I was thinking of something very similar. I was thinking of the case where somebody moves into the state. And so that language, the language here, covers that circumstance. I mean, I don't know what the special or limited open enrollment periods are under the ACA. Maybe you could just tell us what that means.
Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, a change in address, a change in family status, a change in job status, the number of life event changes would trigger a special enrollment period.
Yeah.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just hopefully can add to the clarification. There's it's already in state law for certain qualifying events, you know, leaving your parents' plan, those types of things. That's already all covered. I think that's why you don't have to articulate that in this particular amendment.
Okay. So any other questions on the amendment? I don't see any. All those in favor of the A7 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So we've adopted that amendment. And that's your final one, Representative Atkins?
That's all we got, Mr. Chairman. I am open to some of the other amendments that I believe are in your packets, but they are not my my author's amendments, Mr. Chair.
Did we do? Representative Abler.
Do you care what order you do them in? You don't care what order we do them in, do you?
No, I don't.
Mr. Chair, I move the A13 amendment.
The A13, is that dash 305?
No, it's just the A13. Okay. It's a short one.
Oh, okay. So Representative Abler moves the A13 amendment. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, I have a series of two, and they were... there's some issues that are prevailing, and I don't know if this is the right bill for these, but they are issues that are related to the life outside the exchange, and this is a bill that purports to do that. And if you look at the timestamp, they're 45 minutes ahead of the deadline. And so Mr. Pender drafted some things, and so they're at least conceptually sound, but they may need a little bit of technical work, and I've talked to the health plans about these, and they're interested to talk to me about them, and so if they could be adopted, that would be great. The A13 talks about a reverse bidding that's going on, right now as a single, there's four of us together, but as a small clinic, we have no bargaining power whatsoever. And so if we want to be in a managed plan, we're lucky to get in. Some people can't even get in. So we're in, and they say, well, be happy about it, you're in. And we say, well, that's great, and here's the contract. Could you change this word? And they say, well, sure, we could, but then you're not in. And so they provide us a fee schedule, and there's absolutely no bargaining power whatsoever. Allina, Mayo, Fairview, they get to do some bargaining. And I think it would be obvious, but some of the fee schedules are actually approaching what it costs to do business. There's been a lot of discussion in the past about cost shifting from medical assistance to the commercial market. And it's very perilous when the commercial market gets to be close to breaking even and you're trying to just stay open. So this to me seems obvious, and I can't think anybody would find this to be offensive. And it may need some technical work, and it'll create some discussion. But this just says that you can't pay a provider in the commercial market less than it costs them to do business. We've already agreed in the Medicaid market, it's okay to work below cost. But at some place, at least you got to make back your overhead. So I hope that Representative Atkins can accept this, and members would support this amendment.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in looking at it, I don't know quite frankly, technically, if it does precisely what Representative Abler has described, in the section in which it is going into, I'm not saying that it doesn't, I'm just, it is in an information disclosure section of the bill, so it may or may not achieve exactly what he's looking to do, but I'm not averse to placing it in the bill for at least further discussion between Representative Abler and the carriers to talk about what sort of information disclosure that would obviously it's I don't have a vote on this committee, so I look to the members of who are probably more knowledgeable than I am about that, but in terms of disclosure, that doesn't necessarily seem like a bad thing to have disclosed.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I don't know if you're open to this or not, but I guess I know at least for me sometimes some of these issues with the insurance providers and all those things and how this would affect them. Is there any chance if somebody from the health plans would want to just shed light on what this means for them? And if not, that's okay. We can try to make a best guess, but just thought that might be helpful so we understand what this means for them.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Phil Griffin, Representative Preferred One. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm here tonight speaking on behalf of not only Preferred One, but the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and we have spoken with Representative Abler and are cognizant of the problems that he is bringing to the committee tonight. The goal of health plans, and particularly my health plan, which is owned by providers, I can't even think of who my providers are. are keeping me.
There's a lot of them.
Fairview Memorial and a group of physicians own our company, and they are not interested in paying low provider fees. In fact, they come to us with increases in provider fees every year when we negotiate with them that are far beyond what we can bring to the market. So I guess it's a long way of saying, Mr. Chairman, that we know where Representative Abler wants to go with this, but the issue here is trying to determine what the cost of care is. And I won't go into a lot of detail. I know the hour is late and time is running short, but many of you have already read the Time Magazine article which talks about the costs of care and where we are in this crazy healthcare market, which really isn't a market. And so we don't know that the definition gets us there. We want to continue to work with Representative Abler on these issues. I'm not so sure putting it in the bill right now would be our preference. In fact, I can look at my colleagues, and I think they're going to shake their heads and say we'd rather not have it go on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr.
Questions
Chair.
For Mr. Griffin? I don't see any. Is there any comment from the Commerce Department or from the Department of Health in terms of is this going to have a fiscal note effect?
Mr. Chair, we have to, Commerce has to do the information disclosures and collect the data. If you add one more piece of data for us to collect, I imagine we'll.
Okay, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler. I'm trying to look at this and put it into the bill and figure out what you're doing. I hope I'm on the right version of the bill here, but I think that this is doing is you're adding to the information disclosure that the health carrier has to submit, and what you're adding here seems to be something that doesn't fit in the bill where you've put it. I mean, if I'm reading this right, this is now saying, or it would say, that one of these items of information that would have to be submitted would be claims payment policies and practices, including provider fee schedules, that are not less than provider's overall cost of providing care. So I think I see where you're going. I mean, as a provider, I know you don't want to be paid less than it costs you to provide care, and certainly none of the providers I represent want that either, but I don't really see that it fits here or that you're going to be able to do what you want to do by putting it here in the bill where you're intending to put it. So I guess I wouldn't support it at this point, Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
As I said, I actually requested this of Mr. Pender a couple weeks ago, and it must have got buried in his pile. I reminded him on Friday of a bill coming up. And if you look at the timestamp, it was 45 minutes before deadline. And so I don't think it belongs in this particular section, but I think the topic, you know as well as I, Representative Liebling, if you have a piece of language in a bill, then people help you put it in the right spot. And so I'm bringing you the trouble, the challenge that we have. I don't, and the question about cost, but it's a very real problem. And the advantage we have is I'm a collaborative type with the plans, and you put a little language in a bill, then they're much more eager to talk to you than if the language is not in the bill. And this is going to Ways and Means, and I'm sure by the time we get to that, we can perfect some definition of cost and find the right place to put it in the bill. And I think it would be helpful to if you could agree to put in the bill for tonight. And this bill has a ways to go. It's going to go to the floor and then to a conference committee, perhaps. So I think that would be helpful if you could do that. So that's my request of members. And it's, so if you could do that, that would be a good thing. And we could try to resolve this matter and create kind of a floor. So that's what I'm trying to create as a floor.
And it does have to go to Ways and Means. And you can get an agreement with the plans. We can make an amendment there.
Yeah.
And Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to say, Representative Abler, I think this is a lot bigger issue than to be done the way you're trying to do it. And I get your point about the lateness and all that and getting things worked on. But I guess I would be much more comfortable with what Representative Hunt is proposing, that you continue to work on this until Ways and Means and then offer something as an amendment there, rather than put it on the bill now. I think that's what Representative Huntley was suggesting.
Well,
I frankly don't feel comfortable putting this on this bill at this time.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would add a perspective on this amendment also. You know, and I maybe just embellish or expand a little bit on what Representative Abler said, and he's open to correct me if he thinks I'm wrong. But basically, the larger providers generally negotiate a higher reimbursement rate, and the smaller providers, they get the shaft or the lower reimbursement rate. So this will raise costs, okay, but it'll treat the smaller provider equal with the larger provider who has a lot more leverage for the number of patients that they have with a particular provider. I mean, that's what I see is really going on here. The problem is, you know, it's going to raise cost. I'm a little bit conflicted about it myself, but I can see if you want to add it on and then have discussions about it through the process. But really, the solution, in my opinion, is repeal the HMO law, get rid of the networks and everything else, and go with 140% over Medicare reimbursement to providers right across the board. You'd save millions in paperwork and administration costs. That would more than offset any additional costs for reimbursing providers. 140% over Medicare reimbursement rates. You already got the Medicare reimbursement rates. Get rid of the HMO and the networks. Get rid of all the administration and just pay the people. That's all you have to do. The providers who provide health care. But anyway, those are my thoughts.
Any further discussion of the A13 amendment? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I both agree with Representative Abler and Representative Liebling that this is not a small thing, but this is an important thing. Because in greater Minnesota, there may be, you might not be able to provide the same care at the same cost as in the metropolitan area. If you have a certain critical mass of patients, you can cover the overhead for the equipment. But when we've got in this bill X amount of miles or time of drive, you know, to provide the services for an area, then there are going to be cases of where you've got to look at making sure that you don't drive somebody out of business. Sure, you can provide it, but we had earlier last week, we had a bill discussing dental care, and we talked about providers for the government program, dental care, that went out of business, and we didn't have anyone to provide that in the area. So that if we're going to do this appropriately, do this right, and not damage or hurt the wonderful health system we've got in the state, we need to address both what Representative Abler and Representative Liebling are talking about here because, frankly, we no longer have just a little bit that's a loss to providers. That I fear that what we're stepping into may stretch that out to where we no longer can afford the health system we've got, can't afford to have providers in rural Minnesota, and in you know, there's wait times and other issues. So I guess I lean towards having some language in there and having the you know, little stick in the side to make sure that something gets done, rather than with, you know, all of these extended meetings and the time we're putting in, having something fall through the cracks. Because this is too important of a bill and a step we're doing not to force us to fix it and do it right. So I guess I would support A13.
Any further discussion on the A13 amendment? Representative Atkins, did you want to make one last?
No, Mr. Chair. I think it's been a very thoughtful discussion. I'll leave it to the preference of the committee.
Okay. All those in favor of the A13 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
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 I think the ayes have it.
Division?
Serious?
All those in favor, please raise their hand. All those opposed? Like the eyes have it. Especially since I'm deaf in this ear. Okay, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
And next amendment, Representative Abler, do you have another one?
Well, yeah, I can just, well, actually, this is going to go better. I'd like to move to A12, and I've listened to Representative Liebling on this, but this is, I'm going to explain the problem, and I don't think this is anywhere near ready for prime time. I appreciate the members' help on the last thing, and I will work with the plans, et cetera. The A12 thing talks about different kinds of providers who are not allowed in plans, and this is becoming a more and more great problem, and it's an ill-defined part of the basic health, about the essential health benefits. The term actuarial equivalent is terrifying all kinds of providers, including Children's Hospital, even. A group as large as that. And frankly, just to, and it shocks me that a group as big as that is worried about having getting in this bill, and they're in this bill as an amendment to clean up their language, and I don't fault them for that, because they're absolutely worried. They have one of the finest operations, because they're absolutely worried. They have one of the finest operations anywhere around. The four, you know, and they do tremendous things, and they're worried about being included. This amendment, if you can cut through how not tidily it was drafted, notice again the timestamp, 2 minutes later than the last one, says if you're going to provide ultrasound therapy services, people who can do ultrasound therapy in their practice should be allowed to do it.
Yeah.
That's all it says. And so if you're going to provide psychiatric or counseling services, those people who are licensed to do counseling need to be included. I fought long and hard to get licensed professional clinical counselors into medical assistance over the objections of some other group I won't name that was an obstacle for several years. And other professions such as mine struggle with this as well. And it's a real problem. And I don't know where to address it. This amendment doesn't get even close to what I was hoping that what it would say, so I'm going to withdraw it in a second. But I want to point out, this is a real issue. And perhaps by the time it gets to Ways and Means of the floor, I'll have some language that makes sense. But I want to tell you, thank you for the last vote, because putting language in a bill gets people to talk to you. An amendment that gets offered and withdrawn is like amendment that was offered and withdrawn. It's like Marcel Marceau walking in the wind, you know. There's just nothing to there's nothing there, you know. Does that date me, Mr. Chair? I'm sorry. Anyway, so that's the problem, and so with that, I'm going to withdraw it, and I appreciate members' attention to it, but it's a very real problem, so thank you.
Okay, who's got the A11 amendment? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a number of amendments, and get with the amendment. The first couple are just actually wording updates related to what was discussed in the last committee, the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. The A15 amendment deals with the topic. I thought I'd take that one first since Representative Abler just mentioned the children's hospitals. And in the underlying bill, the children's hospitals and their clinics, the ones that, you know, we want everyone to be able to refer to because they've got really specialty services that people are helicoptered in to take advantage of. They are in the bill defined as essential community providers. And the original wording was a little broad and could potentially bring in.
Representative Loeffler, which amendment are
this
you?
This is the A15.
A15. So Representative Loeffler has moved the A15 amendment.
Right. And what this did was address the issue of their affiliated specialty clinics. If those of you who serve on the policy committee might remember that discussion, and they wanted to check the language, and as far as I know, there's peace in the valley and this works, and so I would move the A15 amendment just to make that work.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I'm not aware of that doesn't mean that there is no opposition. I just haven't been approached by anyone with opposition to the amendment, and I think it is, in fact, just clarifying.
Okay. Any other discussion of the A15 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? So the A15 amendment is adopted.
And then, Mr. Chair, the next one I'm going to move is the A16 amendment. And this, thank you very much, Ms. Cleveland, during the break, took it upon herself to address the issue that came up this morning, which is that the A6 amendment for limited scope dental plan kind of wiped out what the policy committee did, which was to add pediatric. So it'll be limited scope pediatric dental plan, so we know what we're talking about. And so she took the time to find the 8 places or whatever that refers to this throughout the bill, and it just makes it clear that we're dealing with dental plans that only apply to children, which is what is required.
Representative Atkins.
Looks good to me, Mr. Chairman.
Yep.
Okay. Any further discussion of A16? I don't see any. See, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. So the A16 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, the next amendment I would offer is the A14 amendment. And this
so Representative Loeffler moves the A14 amendment.
And this one deals with accreditation, which is a multi-year process for plans that haven't gotten to that process. The amendment we adopted earlier today, suggested by the author, dealt with plans that are already accredited. The underlying bill says they have plans will have until 2018 or 2020, depending on size and where they are in the market, to achieve this. And I've worked with the health department on this language to just say that they have to show they're making progress, that they don't just wait till, you know, 2019 and then try and think they can cram it in when it's a multi-year process. And they have suggested a couple of further amendments that I think will be quick and easy, and that is on line 1.12, an oral amendment of changing certified to accredited in both places.
Okay, so
and then one
Loeffler moves.
And Mr. Chair, just one more change, and on line 1.13 to change December to January. Given all that we've given them to do, they'd like a little extra time.
2014.
And 2014, excuse me.
Yeah.
Not just a month. And this is line 1.13.
Okay, so Representative Loeffler And do you want to just incorporate that into your...
And I would be glad to incorporate that into my A14 amendment.
Okay. So, Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, seems good to me with those changes.
Okay. Any further discussion of A14, Representative Kernhagen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that the amendment, you know, we're giving the carrier the goal of certification attestation, and now we're micromanaging him along the way. They have to submit reports and everything else. I just think, I mean, at what point does government not control every aspect of our life? And, you know, we want you to do this, and by the way, we want you to submit reports that you're doing it when we, to make sure you're doing it. You know, and then everybody's got to be paid to send that information back and forth, unless I'm misinterpreting it. It just seems like we've got the goal, and now we're going to micromanage the process of the goal. And of course, everybody's got to be paid to keep track of all that stuff. And hey, they got the goal, they got the point. Let them do it. And if they don't, then they miss the mark. I don't know. Those are my thoughts.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Loeffler. Wait a minute. Representative Quam is first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And because of this process, and we've seen this all along since the passing of the PPACA and the federal level, that regulations and the evolution takes time. They're complex. And frankly, I agree that we should not be micromanaging because we don't know, you know, that they continually shift or change things at the federal level, and we adapt, but we don't know what is coming up with new rules until they present them. And that, frankly, I see this as more busy work because they've got enough, I guess, activity coming, just keeping up with all the new regulations, new rules. We create the exchange, and we've got a board, and that board has to do activities, and it's going to come up with rules and processes. So frankly, this is going to be so fluid for even the next few years that I think it'd be a lot of these reports would be obsolete by the time they're submitted because there'll be changes. And I like the intent of making sure they keep to it, but just with the transition in churn and turmoil, I don't think it's practical that we enforce this on them along with all the other change. So I guess I would not support this amendment.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the concerns that are raised, the bill right now recognizes a number of long-established national accreditation agencies. We heard early how most of our plans in Minnesota are already accredited, and the bill provides that they don't have to do anything more other than because they already are accredited. This just says, and I don't feel it's very onerous, it says that when you're in the process, you should say which of the flavors of accreditation you've picked, and who you've applied for, and you know, your projected date to achieve that. And I think that this has nothing to do with some of the issues that were raised about federal guidance or anything else. This is actually just a consumer protection provision that we've had before. And if people have further information that they need about this, I would send it to our state witnesses who actually deal with the accreditation and understand this process more than I do. But the basic concept is that they just tell us which one of these flavors of accreditation that they've decided they want to go for, and so that there's some assurance that they've actually are looking at that, because that is a requirement for them to stay in the market, and they shouldn't be surprised when time passes if they get kicked out of the market just because they didn't know about it. This just says you let us know. We are going.
I'm going to ask for a vote now, and all those in favor of the A14 amendment as amended signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Aye. The amendment passes.
And Mr.
So the A14 is adopted.
Mr. Chair, my last amendment is the A11, and this was brought to me at the request of NAMI, and they have been talking with the plans And it just assures that in our network adequacy, that they address mental health and substance use treatment, which we know there is a shortage of workers. We heard this morning how even our state agencies have a hard time finding mental health workers. And so there is a waiver provision in the bill, and it just provides underline 1.15 that it will automatically expire after 2 years, and so then they have to, you know, consider, you know, then they have to appeal to the commissioner as to what the circumstances are that they're not able to find providers in their network to meet this need. And I would like to delete lines 1.13 and 1.14. And with that, I've been told that there's been good discussion between all impacted.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Loeffler, for the amendment. I support it.
Any further discussion of the A11 amendment as amended? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No. So no.
A11 amendment as amended is adopted. What else do we got? Oh, Abler has one?
Yeah.
Oh, Abler, you have another one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Abler.
Well, this one's longer, so that's good. Move the A130305, and I have a witness to that. This is the long version of what I said before about the discrimination in providers. The ACA has a clause in it about allowing for free access to providers, that they should include them. And just to remind people, as Mr. Coons comes to sit at the table, this term actuarial equivalent is a word that's very frightening to a lot of provider groups, and there's still a lot of competition. With the evolution of advanced practice nursing and physician's assistants, there's some of those professionals still feel pressure on their license from the groups that they supplanted, and which amazes me at this late date of those professions. And so that's why laws get written, to protect groups so that they can be there. And Mr. Coons provided this to me, and I wanted to give him a chance to talk about it. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'll call on my witness, if he could.
Mr. Coons.
Thank you. My name is David Coons. I lobby for the Northwestern Health Science University and the Injury Help Coalition, a group of attorneys and providers. The Affordable Care Act that was just passed had a non-discriminatory provision in it. It's a limited provision. It's much similar to our provisions on freedom of choice for under 62A.15 and 62Q.23. The difference is the 62A.15 applies to traditional insurance plans, and the 62Q.23 applies to health plan coverage or HMO coverage. What we asked the attorneys to do when they looked at this new provision was to say, what are the forms of possible discrimination that can take place either for the consumer or at the provider level? And so they looked at this provisions and said, if you were trying to address the problems and give the consumer the ability to evaluate their health plan that they are purchasing, you have to have provisions that everybody can understand. And one of the areas was the choice of your primary care physician, or the right to refer to a specialist, and that's in the PPACA Act. What we're doing in this bill is making sure that if you're properly licensed, no matter who you are, the consumer has a right to see you, and we shouldn't have interference in that. The second provision that PPACA covers is the material benefits and coverage terms, and that's very similar to what we have in our current insurance law. But what we needed to do, or what we wanted to raise the issue, was what are the discriminatory forms that can take place within those terms or those contracts. And so there's seven, if you look on page 2.7 to 2.18, those are the various ways that currently you could have discriminatory practices within a classification of providers. And I can tell you right now that we have this going on in some of our health plans now. You don't know that when you buy the health plan coverage that you're having, but these are the forms that it can take place. For instance, in chiropractic, we have one health plan that has a 30% withhold on all providers. We also have, from that same health plan, an additional thing they put it, it isn't in the contract, but they have another contract with the provider that then limits the average annual amount that that the provider can provide in services to $250 a year. Now, the consumer didn't know that when they bought the plan coverage. So these are the type of things that I think Representative Abler was talking about. So what we then, the attorneys did in lines 2.19 through 2.25, they said, look, there's basically two types of impermissible things we don't allow. A classification based on employment group or status of the practitioner, the official role of the healthcare practitioner or provider network, or two classifications based on race, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, national origin, religion, age, disability, skin color, ethnicity. These are basic things, and we know what forms of discrimination those are. So what this bill is really, or this amendment is saying, but you cannot discriminate within a class of providers. And that affects all kinds of providers out there. Now, does it say you cannot have a withhold? No. Does it say you cannot have a copay? Does it say you cannot have a deductible? No, this amendment does not do that. What the amendment says, it must be applied equally across all boards, or all providers, if you're going to put a restriction in. And that's what we're trying to get in this amendment. And then last, we say, yes, we do allow you to have permissible classification exceptions if they can be measured and they're based on cost and quality, and that there's a review by the commissioner for those. And last provision in the bill that we believe is very important is that we do not allow providers to waive anything by contract, because it's frankly, this is a leverage that is used by some of the health plans. So that's what's not allowed in the amendment. I'd like to stand for questions if you have.
Mr. Kuntz, is this going to raise health care costs?
I don't think it really will raise costs. I think what it does is put all the cards on the table, and you're allowed to, everybody plays by a level playing field. And I know that we have providers, for instance, in back there, if chiropractors were fully used, you may be experiencing a 20% savings in your back care costs right today. But because of many of these provisions that are in here, the consumer is directed away from chiropractic care. And that's in your current system. So I really want the committee, and thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to present this amendment. I think as you move forward and are working on on implementing your exchange program, these are the very issues that are going to impact every provider and every consumer. So,
Representative Atkins, do you have a comment on this amendment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the spirit of a large part of the amendment. I have some reservations like you do because I don't know precisely what the impact cost-wise would be, though I think Mr. Kunz has a point about, you know, certain types of care might actually bring down the cost. I just honestly don't know.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I heard Mr. Kunz describe 1.15 on, but I'm concerned about the amendment from 1.4 to 1.14, where we're changing coverage for children who going to a limiting age with a reference, getting rid of E, which is health plan companies shall comply with the equal access requirements of section 62A.15. I have no idea what these references are, and I wonder if Mr. Chun or someone could explain to us what we're doing there with those families, because that's not dealing with the providers. It seems like it's definition of families and access to continuation and conversion policies, and I'd like to know what that is.
Mr. Chun.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I'm not very familiar with these provisions. It may be good if perhaps Commerce staff could, you know, go over the your or address your concerns there.
Okay. Someone. Thank you.
Ms. Von Rudin.
For the record, it's Alyssa Von Rudin, Health Policy Advisor with the Department of Commerce. And this particular section, to your concerns, Representative Loeffler, from line 1.5 to 1.12 are actually taken from a technical change that we made in a separate bill that our Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley is carrying for ACA conformity purposes. So the language was taken from that.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Loeffler.
And Ms. Van Rudin, and what about the 1.13 and 1.14? Is that, you didn't say that was included?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, that is a change from, that's a new provision. And by deleting that language.
And Ms. Van Rudin, could you tell us what?
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, sorry. What section 62A.15 is, or at least take a guess at it if you don't have the statutes memorized.
Ms. Von Rudin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I would rather not hazard a guess, but I can certainly look into it for you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Since we know that some portion of this is already covered in another bill and we don't understand what the implications are of 1.13 and 1.14, I would hope that Representative Abler would consider dropping at least this portion of the amendment, because I don't think we should, if we don't understand what it applies to, we shouldn't probably adopt it.
Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it was my intention to create a discussion about this, and I didn't write it. Some people that, but I know about the problem. And so, Mr. Kunz has been on a long time, and the problem is this. This amendment actually should become adopted and should become law. It's not going to become adopted and become law this year, most likely. There's some technical, I don't know about that little bit of it, but the problem is very real. And I'm going to make a prediction that as the ACA moves forward, as exchange bills, exchange gets to work and starts sending out products and actuarial equivalencies become real, about which the legislature has made no position at all, leaving it up to the exchange board, you'll be having people talk to you, and you'll be carrying a bill yourself to handle some grievance made by the board that you think is a wrong decision they made. And I'm just trying to call attention to it ahead of time so that when you see it happening, you go like, oh, now I know what they're talking about. In the name of cost, a lot of things happen. In the name of quality, things get measured that aren't even real. And in the name of access, we do all kinds of things to make sure people can get something. And as the bronze plans come along, and as networks shrink, and you'll see good doctors and nurses and chiropractors and nurse practitioners not be in networks they used to be in as they shrink the availability of sites people can go to and as they create competition and force some of these businesses, these providers, not just chiropractors, but other more mainstream even and just regular clinicians out of business because of these cost and access issues, you will understand why I brought this point today. And so just making a prediction. It's meant to be friendly, and I'm here as a positive influence on the system. But having lived 34 years in my practice and watched what happens to many people and similar practices and across the allied health professions and 14 years here working with every profession, I know they experiment on us and then they export it. And that's how it seems to go. And so I'm just telling you what I've seen as an early warning that these kinds of situations are going to come up and these sort of bills will be passed with 134 votes or 100 anyway as the years go by. So I appreciate the dialogue. I'm sorry, I don't know what those two lines mean. Somebody besides me stuck it together, but the issue is real. My concern is quality care for everybody who can possibly get it at a reasonable price and at a convenient place to your house. Because if you don't see if the doctor you want to see isn't in your network and you don't go, it's like you don't have any insurance at all. And if you haven't got access because it's too far away or you can't see the kind of doctor you want, you don't have any insurance, which flies in the face of the whole thing we've been working on, and many of you cheered about the ACA. Actually might make it worse. I'm just trying to make it not worse. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Representative Abler withdraws the A13-0305.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to just comment on an amendment that I don't have in front of me that wasn't prepared in time. Just another matter about this, and it's short. The medical group managers have cautioned me about some things that are going to happen. The bronze plan is going to have a $2,000 deductible. Many people are moving into a higher deductible plan with these bronze type plans as they move out of their other plans. Many people have a lower deductible now. But what they're concerned about is that the deductibles will be met in the first part of the year by people going to their regular clinic. And often they've had copays now, and now they have a deductible as they bought a different plan. And so the clinics are concerned they have to eat the whole bit of their deductible because the people aren't accustomed to paying deductibles. And they had an idea about creating a fund to pay the first some lost deductible, which didn't get done in time, which may have been problematic anyway. But I'm just going to remind you that that problem may come to your door again as the medical groups come forward. And these are medical group, medical clinics in your towns with 10, 20 doctors, allied professionals there or whatever, just regular clinics. And they don't know how they're going to survive some of this stuff. And they're concerned about being included in the networks, the same as my amendment was, not just based on provider type. They're concerned about skinny networks. They're concerned about access. And they're concerned about being able to serve the people that have gotten used to going there for a long time. So I won't go on and on. I just wanted to bring this to your attention so you can be aware of some of the perils of any big change in health insurance. So, Mr. Chair, should I withdraw the amendment I didn't offer? Thank you. And I'm done, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Are there any other amendments? No. So I don't see any. So Atkins, Representative Atkins, if you want to make a final comment, and then we'll vote.
Mr. Chair, I'm done, too. That's a good bill. Please vote green.
Representative Grunhagen.
Wait, we're to the bill now, right?
Right.
Okay. I was hoping we'd get there sooner or later. I do have a few questions, okay? Why, Representative Atkins, I just don't see that this bill is necessary. But I want to ask you a couple of questions, and or some of your testifiers. Why are you imposing this on the private market outside of the exchange?
Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, the core foundational question about regulation in a competitive market industry is what set of rules do you have the players play by when they compete in the marketplace? if you're going to address the question about whether or not we should have any standards applicable to the marketplace, that's the foundational question about whether or not there should be any regulation at all. I suppose that could be a position you could take, that there should be no regulation, no consumer protection, no standards that plans need to adhere to. What we've tried to do in the bill is lay a set of consumer protections that are the same for all carriers, no matter where you participate, so consumers can feel comfortable that the standards are the same no matter if they buy, as Redford Atkins said, online or from a kiosk or from a Main Street broker.
Yeah, well, according to the bill on line 1.5, one of the main purposes of this, or 1.4, I'm sorry, is to minimize adverse selection. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Mr. Chair, without my sidekick, Jeff Barch, I would feel bad about bringing up adverse selection without him to counter me, but yes.
Okay. And just some quick follow-up questions. Okay. I understand you're trying to minimize adverse selection because the problem is you get the sick people inside the exchange, okay, and they migrate to an expensive plan that pays well because they're having a lot of claims versus outside of the exchange. But you're aware, Mr. Ragala, is that how you say it? Ragala?
Munson-Ragala.
Okay.
Too many hyphens.
Okay.
Where's the green here?
We'll dispense with the whatever. Anyway, we'll get right to the point so we move this along. The thing is, plans right now, and correct me if I'm wrong, they have to pool their business risk already. So whether you have plans inside of the exchange or outside of the exchange, the claims that you have from the from your health insurance pool or insureds already is pooled. So you already mitigate and minimize the adverse selection based on current law. This simply adds another layer of micromanagement into the private market, which is simply going to drive up costs, create more bureaucracy, and lead to inefficiencies, rather than solve the problem which is already being solved with the current laws of pooling business both inside and outside the exchange. Would you please respond to that?
Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Mr. Chair, Russell Grunhagen. I would posit that having three sets of rules and regulations for a carrier to comply with would actually result in more inefficiency and cost for that carrier. From talking to the carriers, their point, and it's a well-taken point, which is why we've been working with them on the regulations, is they're okay with one set of rules if they're a reasonable set of rules. The concept of having multiple sets of rules to comply with, I think, should horrify anyone trying to be compliant.
Ms. Chair, just...
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you. Thanks for your indulgence. But that's what you're doing. You're creating more than one set of rules. I guess I'd like to hear from somebody in the private industry regarding this this provision here, and whether Jeff Barth or somebody else from the industry that could come forward and just give their perspective on this. Catherine Commit.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Commit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Grunhagen. Thanks for your question. I think that what Mr. Munson-Ragala said is said that it depends on if the rules are reasonable, and I think that is key, that he's right that if there is only one set of rules, that certainly will simplify things. Part of the problem is that our industry here in Minnesota has grown up around a couple of different plans, an indemnity type of policy, an HMO policy. Blue Cross is governed under a separate statute, and so it's just evolved that way, and we've made it work somehow. And now with this particular bill, there's an attempt to try to make those rules the same, and the real crux of the problem is how do you do that and make it reasonable for everybody, because some parts of the business have operated under one set of rules and others have had to follow different rules that maybe have a much higher standard. And so it's kind of like it's in the eye of the beholder. How do we, if the goal is to equalize that across the industry, then how do we do it in a reasonable way?
Representative Gruenhagen.
Do you believe this bill is trying to do it in a reasonable way, Mr. Mrs. Commit?
Mrs. Commit.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gruenhagen, I think that the intent is honorable. They're trying to make it as fair as they can across the industry. I will say that we have some concerns about some of the direction that various provisions are going, and we have been in working closely with the departments, both the Department of Health and the Department of Commerce, and with Representative Atkins, and with Senator Lurie, who's carrying it in the Senate, because we want to make the system work for everybody. But so my answer is that we're trying to contribute to a solution here and try to make it work for everyone.
I'm just about done, Mr. Chair. Thank you. But isn't it true that you already that you will pool your business both in and outside the exchange, that the industry does?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gruenhagen, yes, you're correct. So for any an individual product that a health plan sells, the products that they sell inside the exchange and outside the exchange for an individual product are all going to be pooled in one pool. The same thing with their small group. Whatever they sell inside the exchange or outside the exchange will all be pooled in one pool. And so when we talk about adverse selection, the selection is against insurance companies, against one health plan with another. It's not the exchange that is taking any risk. So no one is selecting against the exchange. What they're doing is looking at which an individual is looking at which product would best serve their needs, and they may decide for whatever reason based on cost and quality that they prefer one product over another. And if a sicker population is trending more towards a particular plan, then that would be adverse selection. But there are some mechanisms that the federal government anticipated and they've put into place, like risk adjustment, reinsurance, and risk corridors to try to mitigate that issue on the backside.
Mr. Chair. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just for the committee, you know, to bring all this change in such a short period of time to an industry of healthcare is just very poor judgment. I mean, to bring the exchange and then outside the exchange and inside the exchange and try to adverse risk and change underwriting, change the plans. It just takes some time. There's nothing in the ACA, in my understanding, that we have to do this outside of the exchange. I believe we should leave the products outside the exchange alone and let the exchange operate, see, and then begin to modify things. To start changing inside, outside the exchange, it's just an exercise in futility that is going to increase costs, cause even more confusion, and produce frustration in the market, both for providers and for patients seeking care. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Representative Atkins.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Representative Atkins, can you please clarify for me what exactly minimize adverse selection means in your bill?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, I think it's actually been relatively well explained here, and I would tend to agree. We've got, in my opinion, I think we've got kind of two versions of adverse selection going on. One is plan versus plan, and then the other is the concern over whether or not people will use the exchange. And I think that's where the issue gets a little bit confused, and I see people like Representative Abler, who's pretty knowledgeable about this stuff, nodding along with that. And that's where, unfortunately, we start to have this sort of departure of the discussion. And while I am concerned about not pitting the exchange against the outside market, I wouldn't necessarily categorize it. I wish we had a better name for it than adverse selection, because I don't want to I don't think the two are necessarily hand in hand, and I wish there was a better way to define that. I just want to make certain that the purpose of the bill is to have rules that don't favor inside versus outside or outside versus inside, so that we've got that. And the final point I would make is, and one that hasn't been made, is part of the reason we have rules that are the same inside and outside is there's just the chance for pretty serious confusion if you don't. You know, if folks are buying one product inside and the rules are different inside the exchange versus what's going on outside, I think that this is already a confusing area, and that just adds to it. Thank you for letting me editorialize on the answer, but that was the one piece that really had not been raised tonight.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. I do have a real legitimate, well, we all think we have a legitimate question, so I ask again. Representative Gruenhagen tried to explain what the adverse selection is. I still do not understand what the adverse selection means, and if you're able to clarify it for me, I'll move to my second question, and I'll get over that one.
Representative Atkins.
Yeah, and there's better experts than I, Mr. Chairman, in the room relative to adverse selection, but what it, the essence of it is that you lead people to buy products and have how best to describe it. You have bad risk pooled in the wrong places, and I think that's why the plans spend a great deal of time talking about even if it pools in a certain place, that it's still nonetheless spread throughout the market. But that's the essence of adverse selection, is that as a result of certain market forces, or even arguably gaming of the system, you pool that risk in certain places and cause plans to crash.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Well, it's late and we all want to go home, I'm sure, but I'm just trying to qualify and quantify for me why we're doing this bill in the first place, and I'll ask the question for you, Representative Atkins. In your purpose and scope of the bill, it says to ensure fair competition for health care in Minnesota, to minimize adverse selection, which I believe I'm understanding, to spread the risk from those who are not healthy to those who are healthy, hopefully we all in this room, to ensure that health plans are offered in a manner that protects consumers, that's a good thing, wouldn't you agree, and promotes the provision of high-quality, affordable health care and improved health outcomes. I think we all can agree that that's an important measure. Now, I thought we had that already. I thought we had that already. When I look at all the data that I've been reading in 2-3 years I've been here from the Minnesota Hospital Association, they say that Minnesota, they ranked, we all know this, Minnesota has the best overall health care quality in the nation and the fourth highest quality score for hospital care. That's something we should be proud of. Since 2006, Minnesota has ranked in the top three states for its health care, considered gold standards. I'll read again. Minnesota is among the lowest cost states for hospital care, and Minnesotans are getting the best health care and value of this of any state in the nation. Minnesota was the first state to publicly report adverse health events, and it goes on and on and on, Representative Atkins, that we are the best. Minnesota is among the 10 top states that with the lowest overall rates in 13 patient safety indicators. So in your scope and purpose of the bill, correct me if I'm wrong, don't we already ensure fair competition for health care in Minnesota? Don't we already ensure that plans are offered in a manner that protects our consumers? And don't we all already have great health outcomes? Other than adverse selections, I skip that because I still don't quite understand that. Don't we already have that? And what is, if so, what? Why is this bill necessary?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative McDonald, because while we do have an excellent health care system in Minnesota, there is some lack of clarity about what exactly the rules are, and I think that's why the plans have come up and said that they've been happy to work with the two departments to try to clarify what those rules are relative to things like accreditation, the network marketing efforts, and informational disclosures.
And, you know, Representative McDonald, we may be the best in the country, that doesn't mean we're perfect. And if you look, for instance, the latest news about cesarean section rates, they're just as bad in Minnesota as they are in the rest of the country. And we're running about 30% C-sections, and we ought to be probably about 15. So we have plenty of room to improve health care in this state, even though we're at the top right now.
In closing, then, I thought the exchange bill was to do that, to make us more perfect. How does this associate with the HICS?
Mr. Chairman, the
Representative
health,
Atkins.
The Health Insurance Exchange, now known as Minsure, doesn't control the whole market. It's designed to allow people to access those federal tax credits and to enhance competition among plans. This market rules bill will apply market-wide to all of the plans offered in Minnesota and offer greater clarity to those plans in terms of what the direction is that they need to follow.
And what we need to do is make sure, if there's anybody in the audience that wants to testify, if they would come down right now. And I don't see anybody standing up, so I think they just want to go home. So, Representative Dean, get your last shot here.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Representative Atkins, I think a lot of the apprehension about this bill is just kind of part and parcel from the main bill itself, and save a lot of that. But the largest apprehension that I have continues to be the largest apprehension I've had with the main bill, which is the relationship between the exchange market and non-exchange market, and also the folks that I'm getting a better understanding from the testimony and from learning a little bit about this bill is that the folks who are going to provide insurance inside and outside the exchange spread their business across both, and this is going to be affecting both. So I can understand kind of how you want to look at that, how you want to think about it. And the way I kind of read through it, it was kind of like an operating system on a computer that, you know, there's this sort of a set of rules that things would have to go through depending on what application you have, two different applications going through the same thing. But when I look at it, I just wonder, you know, and I'm comparing this to other states and trying to compare those bills, I don't really see something similar. Is there something similar in another state that has enacted this, that is set up, or is there modeling from Minnesota's version with another state that we're building on? I just wasn't able to find that when I was looking through, and I didn't spend a whole lot of time looking, but I really don't know.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I don't know if it's been modeled after some other state or not. I suspect that the departments, by virtue of working with other health departments and things like NAIC, probably have conversed. I suspect the plans have as well. So it wouldn't surprise me if there's been some influence in terms of what other states have done. But the majority of it is things that we really feel that we need, as opposed to things that the two departments desire to just simply get done. I've asked them to try to narrow the scope of their bill to what really needs to get done, and that's those four or five major areas that are currently in the bill now.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, last thing, just in looking at this, we're hearing from the folks who are going to be providing insurance, you know, across the market. They're going to adapt to whatever system that we have. And there's also, you know, down the road. And the folks that I'm most concerned about are the people who are going to have to shop for and purchase insurance. And the risk is going to be basically distributed to premiums. That's who bears the risk. The people who are going to write the checks that pay for all of this stuff. And I don't think that from the testimony that I heard, I think that the risk is not going to be from the exchange itself. Bears no risk. That government doesn't feel the weight of this. And in a certain extent, the insurance, the folks who are selling insurance aren't exactly bearing the risk. It's going to be the people who are writing the checks to pay for the premiums. I'm very concerned about particularly people who buy small group insurance and other products, their ability to pay for this and stay in business. You're a business owner. You've had to write those checks. You know how scary that can be in moving forward. And that's our biggest concern in moving forward with this is the impact on Minnesotans who are going to inevitably end up paying for this and absorbing the entirety of the risk down the road, both inside and outside the exchange.
Representative Atkins, final comment, and then we're going to vote.
I'd appreciate your support and appreciate your patience this evening.
Okay. All those, I'll renew the motion that House File 779 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The bill passes and goes to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Mr. Chair, over here.
Oh, Representative.
Before we go, I just want to acknowledge the audience. We're tired. The people in the audience have sat through at least 18 hearings, four floor sessions, numerous hearings on this bill, and you know, there's a lot of them are state employees and non and private people, but I just want to commend them for their endurance and acknowledge that they've worked really hard on this, and so that's all. Thanks.
And
they're tired.
Representative Abler and our staff are probably going to go upstairs and continue working when we go home.
Yeah.
A few minutes. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.